This meeting is now being recorded.
Okay, this is Aliza. Hopefully no one is hearing music. Just my voice. We'll try again. Thank you, everyone. Good morning. Welcome. I hope you all had a good evening. So, as I mentioned, we have Dave Dickinson here from Nielsen. We are going to talk about the upcoming Phase 2 consumer survey. The registrant survey will come later this year, but I think maybe Dave will touch a little bit about on the preparations for that as well. The draft of the survey you've seen so far, as we've said, is for consumers. It's really focused on Internet users. And just to provide a little context, I think we've mentioned before, the survey was commissioned as a result of a recommendation from the Implementation Advisory Group that was working on this review. In 2014, they made a recommendation to commission the survey as soon as possible to capture consumers' opinions before new GTLDs really permeated the market. And the idea was to get a sense of choice and trust in the domain name system, prior to new GTLDs really taking hold. So that kind of brought us to Nielsen. We conducted an RFP, and we contracted with Nielsen to do the first phase survey. We are doing a similar survey a year later to measure any sort of differences in opinions, changes in attitudes over time. So the survey that you saw is largely built off of what was fielded a year ago in order to really allow for some comparison points, with some additions and changes to reflect the fact that there are more new GTLDs in the route, and so on and so forth. So I think with that, I can let Dave take over.
All right. I think I can get close enough to this one. Thanks, everyone. So let's see. To advance the slide, first question. One second. Okay. All right, you should be seeing the background slide now. So as was just stated, this is the second year of a program that was designed to assess the current TLD landscape and to measure factors such as consumer awareness, experience, choice, trust with the new TLDs and contrast those with the more what we term the legacy GTLDs, and the system in general. So we interview two different groups. We interview consumers, and that's what this study is. And in that, there's a small naturally occurring representation of registrants, but it's not designed to be interviewing the registrants. We have a separate study that will be fielded in the summer that screens for people who have registered one or more domain names before. The multi-wave program, this is the second wave, and so it was designed to track changes. And I bring that up because as we go through and look at changes here, there may be things that in hindsight we wish we might have done differently, but we want to keep them the same for comparability. And then we can look at other ways to enhance that or change that. So that'll be something that we talk about. The need for comparability, I would say, you know, if this is the end point, which I believe it is, this is the second wave and it's the last wave, we really want to keep – comparability then becomes paramount because we change it, we lose that tracking. If this were to be a longer-term program, I'd say get it right now, make those changes, give up some tracking comparability this time for the future. But I think this is designed to be the last of it, so I'm putting a little more weight on the comparability and consistency. We will be presenting these results or plan to in June. And so what we want to do today is go through the remaining comments that were in the survey, talk about how we can address those changes. There are some areas where I think we need to have some discussion. So we'll go through and do that, and then hopefully we can move on to field. I'll start there. The little icon over on the right-hand side, we're already a little past the date that we fielded this last year, so we do want to get it into the field as quickly as possible. A few weeks, a month isn't going to make a huge difference in comparability, but we do want to get as close to that same fielding point as possible, so we want to move through. The other thing I'll point while I'm on the right-hand side of the page is the survey average just over 25 minutes last year. It was intended to be a 15-minute survey, so we stretched that. And that's long from a respondent experience. So there's suggestions in here to add things. I think if we're going to add stuff, we need to look at removing some stuff. It shouldn't be any longer. Compliance is not the right word, but willingness to keep participating in data quality starts dropping dramatically after about 20 minutes. So who we interviewed, over on the left-hand side of this slide, they were adults 18 plus. There's a question of why didn't we interview people younger than 18, and this is where I'll step aside and say, unfortunately, nobody who was involved with the original design of this survey at Nielsen is still at Nielsen, so I wasn't there, so I don't know why we didn't. We could add some, and we'll get to that point in the survey. We'll talk about that. They had to spend a minimum of 5 hours per week on the Internet. There's a question about that we'll talk about. The countries and the quota systems were designed to represent about 75% of the global online population, Internet users. So that's how we drew that. The sample sizes vary by country, and I thought I'd throw this up here. There's a question about what's the statistical power. This is not exactly statistical power, but a general confidence interval. You can see the sort of confidence intervals we have from the smaller countries, such as I think Nigeria is one of the smaller ones, is 100. They're a little bit bigger than that, but up to China is 1,100. You can see the confidence interval around the in-country results. But also, we don't tend to look at the in-country results very much. Just for a few questions, we're mostly looking at it regionally. So the countries within each region are proxies for the region in general. There's a total of 24 countries in here. 18 different languages are it's translated, and people have the option of 18 different languages. So before we get into the question itself, there was a comment, and I thought it was just easier to deal with here. There are the city GTLDs, and we had a question in there that had a few of them, but there wasn't one for every country. And the suggestion was, why can't we have one for every country? And that's a good idea. We can cycle it around so whatever country they're in, they'll see that one. The problem is I couldn't find some for every country. So the ones that are in black or dark, well, it's that light text on the slide, those are the ones that I found reference to as either existing or coming soon. The bolded ones, or the red on my slide, are the ones that I couldn't find anything for those countries, and so I made suggestions of what we might use. We'd want to just get agreement that we're fine, one, with sticking things in there that don't actually exist already. We don't see a methodological problem for that, but want to make sure there's no other concerns around that. And two, does anyone have any issues with the specific ones that I selected? I think they're pretty straightforward. The two I have concerns about probably are Canada. I saw that Toronto was looking at TO as a okay. So the news article I saw was not accurate. Okay, good. So on all sorts of topics. Okay, so in case you couldn't hear it, TO would not be around. So we just do .Toronto perhaps. Thank you.
But
yeah.
Is it also the right one to ask for?
Yeah, so I was going to say that's the other one I had an issue with, not the spelling, but Mexico City, that just seemed to create some complications with other ways or with the length of it and the country and those sorts of things. So I picked a city other than Mexico City for that. But that's just a suggestion. We can put anything in there that you guys feel more comfortable with.
I would have the same comment about Argentina. I mean, Cordoba is interesting, but...
Make sure to identify yourself.
Yes, excuse me. It's Megan Richards speaking for the record.
Yeah.
But that's just a question. Are we looking at the amount people actually use these? Because Cordoba is a nice city, but it's not the
the biggest city in Argentina. I'm not sure how much traffic there is to it. And same for Guadalajara in Mexico.
Yeah,
but it's not...
They're just intended to be used as examples for a in-country city. And Mexico City and Buenos Aires were longer, for some reason when I was doing this, I just thought it would be nicer to have a shorter name. It really...
Jonathan, for the record. Trying to predict what's the question we're asking of people, whether they would use it if...
Sure, the context is just, it comes up in a couple of places. We ask them how they feel about those, how likely they would be to visit, and we ask them awareness of those city-level GTLDs.
So we could be looking at false positives if we're making cities up.
That's correct.
It is.
Yeah, maybe you check about Guangdong. I don't think it's a city, it's a province. Guangdong in China.
Right.
I think I'll have to check. I thought the prefect had the same name, but okay, we can fix that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, this is Fabro. I think I was the one who suggested to add this. I did because I was looking at Brazil, and then Brazilians will have been asking, are you willing to join NYC or something like that? And I say, it's better if you use the local context. I think we do have an issue here with the countries that we don't have. But then if I understand, we have three questions. And the last one is if you are aware of those. So that's only that last one is a problem if we ask something unknown. But the results we have for awareness of this are really, really low. So I would say it's not a major issue if you ask for countries for TLDs that doesn't exist, although there is an issue. But my suggestion would be to go with these suggestions rather than going for New York City for everyone.
Yes, Jordan Buchanan. Yeah, I actually think it's totally fine to include the made-up city codes. I think... you guys should be able to easily distinguish between responses to people, responses where people are responding to real TLDs versus made-up ones. So if we actually see a difference, we'll be able to determine that. And secondly, I'm actually intrigued, like on the awareness question, to see what people say in response to non-existent TLDs. Like if you get similar response rates to that as to things that really exist, that may tell us something about the data on awareness around some of the new TLDs in any case.
And so just one comment I will make just to front load what we'll expect to see is that when you have false entries that seem reasonable, you'll get a relatively high level of false positives. And so I think this will be probably most useful when we look at some of those other questions other than awareness. You know, what's their perception of these city level codes? But
Can I read a comment from Kali Khan? He's online because it's pertinent to this discussion. He says, I don't know if you're on Adobe Connect, but it says, only if a country is highly urbanized, we should not only sample cities, but should also include the countryside.
We already do have a question that has the country code in there. So that's here. We have that for every country in the survey. So that's covered. It's the cities were... I think the way it currently is, we can look at it when we get to that question, is they were sort of a subset of popular ones or ones that were in existence but previously. Berlin, New York City, there was another one, and we wanted to expand that so there was an option for every country.
I'm sorry, he clarified he meant the rural area, so more like the region kind of, as opposed to the country itself.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess it's to what end. It adds length, and we're trying to keep it manageable. These questions are already getting to be a pretty long list for people to sort through. And, you know, what do we learn differently from the region versus the city? Yes, there's an urban-rural divide in most places, but how so we could hypothesize that there would be greater affinity if I'm in a rural area with the region, but if it's not my region, we start going down a rabbit hole of complexity that I'm not sure gives us anything additional, given the limited real estate in the survey.
Dot Falkman?
Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah, similarly, I avoided Barcelona for Spain because of some issues there. So,
Fabro here. I think Cordoba should work, but if you want to use BSAS, which is how they call Buenos Aires, might be an option. But I think Cordoba is okay.
Okay. All right. I think that was my last slide. So, do we want to pull up the survey? Sorry, it was a very short break. I took a nap during it. How about the rest of you? And there we go. Okay. So some of these will be very easy. I'm just going to acknowledge them. We will bold and capitalize weak, so that's very easy. The next comment, though, is... we had a discussion actually about this, about how do you define using the internet? Is 5 hours a large amount or a small amount? There's a few other comments in here, but just on that issue, where we came down again, we said, well, let's keep it consistent just because we want to have as much comparability from one study to the other. So we put this threshold of 5 hours to try and make it very broad. But if somebody's using it an hour a month, I guess the decision was, that's not a significant usage. So again, this is one of those where we thought about defining it, defining the specific behaviors that fall into using the internet, but we said, let's just keep it consistent so our population base is comparable from wave to wave. Was there, that's right. It's why limit it to 18 plus. So here is one where we could expand it to include younger people. That doesn't affect comparability because we can screen them out when we're doing the tracking. It does reduce your comparable sample size within some of the smaller geographies. So whereas you might have 100 in a country right now, you may only wind up with 86. So it does reduce it a little bit. Since we're analyzing on the regional level, probably not a huge thing, and it would give you a glimpse into perceptions from younger people. So that's really a policy choice here, whether we want to broaden it. I believe, and I'm pretty sure I have some Nielsen colleagues on the phone, I'm sorry, I was just looking at a note there. I think it's we can go down in most countries down to 14 without requiring parental permission. I might suggest we go to something like 15 or 13, but if we want to broaden it. And then I would put a maximum on it just to prevent the situation where we might get all of a sudden 50% of our sample in a country from kids. So the question to the team is really, do you see value in getting that voice of the younger audience?
It's Jordan Buchanan. I think I put this question as, I certainly think it would be interesting. Like we often talk about younger people being more adaptable to new technologies. So it seems like it would be interesting to see if we do see a difference in this population.
I tend to agree, but I think you should be careful about the domestic limitations on age. Some are 15, some are 16, but I'm sure you'll take that as well.
Yeah, we'll make sure that we're following SMR guidelines. So. Okay, so I think then we're resolved to go ahead and take it down to the SMR guideline or, say, 15 years of age. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. So how are these numbers determined? They're rough approximations of they were derived from an analysis of the online population, and they're rough approximations of the weight of each of these countries and their contribution to the online population. When I say rough, I mean we rounded it off to 100 instead of making an exact number, those sorts of things. That decision or that weighting was created a year ago. It may have changed slightly, but not a huge amount. So best to keep it the same for weighting. There we go. So two issues on – so question 605, which is where we're capturing some of the convenient sample of registrants is what I'll call it. The comment was, can we define this better? That we actually improved the definition over what it was last time, and I'm fine with defining it further. However, the other thing I'll suggest is, since we have an entire registrant study, and we're looking to create some room to potentially add some questions here, we might just jettison the registrant questions. It will only affect the length for those people who did register, but every little bit helps. And I don't think we used this. It was interesting, but I don't think we used it to a great degree over what we actually got out of the registrant study. So there's half a dozen questions, maybe not quite that many about for registrants. We could just drop them all and just save that for the registrant study. I'm seeing heads nod around the room here, so, okay. So archaic to use paper. I'll tell you how bad it was. I had to print this document 3 times because I kept messing up. I haven't printed anything in so long. okay. Next, which just made me feel all the more bad about wasting trees. there was a suggestion on 615 about adding political group. Think that's a good idea. We'll do that. I might say political group / entity, something like that. Yeah. Roll back up. Just for your information, here's 701. This is where we are kind of introducing the typology for the what we call in the survey extensions and country level. It's not a question here, but you can see the country level stuff that we do. All right, go on down. So the question, it's important to add EU. Fine to do that for those countries. And this is where we will be adding some of those that longer list and making it specific to each country. It says it does not include certain legacy GTLDs. The reasoning is it was designed, again, I wasn't there, but I am pretty sure it was designed to be representative and not exhaustive, just trying to keep things manageable for the respondent. Yeah, 705. It's not, to be quite honest, it's not feasible to try and match browsing data for these participants, the participants in this survey, with their self-reported browsing data. It'd be a lovely thing to be able to do, but you really have to have some sort of instrumented version, and it's just not going to happen. And Nielsen's tried it in other venues, and it does just... The response rates are extremely low. So you can, I mean, obviously there's other types of other ways of getting browsing data, but we're assuming this was linked to these specific individuals, and it's unfortunately just practically it's not feasible at this point in time.
Yeah, so this is Jordan Buchanan. I put this question. I actually did not intend for this to be linked to the same respondents. I think the self-reported information is, I don't care. What I want to know is actually what do people actually do? And I think I know that Nielsen has actual browsing data, at least, I don't know, in every market, but certainly in the U.S.
Yeah.
I'd be much more interested to see what people's actual behavior is as opposed to what they're self-reporting. And I don't care if it's the same population as long as it's
well, that makes it a lot easier. We can certainly I'll check in on what the requirements are, but we can certainly look at just general traffic navigation and browsing data. Yeah.
Sorry, it's Megan Richards again. I had asked you to add .eu, I think, to this one as well. I've lost my notes because
yeah,
I didn't put them on paper.
Yeah, we'll make the list consistent if it's a similar
it's
line
the
of questioning.
Same principle, yes,
yeah.
Because if you're
exactly.
in the UK, well,
yeah.
that's a bad
maybe
example.
Yes, maybe no.
If you're in Germany, you're just as likely to use .eu as .de. Thanks a lot.
And this is Aliza. I just wanted to add on the traffic and people's actual behavior that Jordan brought up, that one of the suggested metrics that we've put on hold for discussion in this group was looking at traffic data and traffic patterns and across TLDs. So that's something that we considered with the implementation advisory group and put it off until the review team came together because that data obviously exists, but it comes with, in some cases, substantial cost. So we wanted to talk that over with the review team to see what types of traffic data you might want to see. So that's something additional we may be able to acquire.
Yeah, so it's Jordan again. I just think I can't imagine self-reported browsing. Like, people don't pay that much attention to, like, which, like, domains are showing up in the URL bar. And it just seems like if we have access to authoritative data on what people are actually doing, like, it just seems vastly more informative than asking them what they think they do. I mean, what they think they do is another interesting question, but it doesn't tell us what's actually happening. And so it would be interesting, you know, back to the discussion with Xavier yesterday, it'd be good to understand what the costs look like and make sure we're responsible with it. But that just seems like much more useful data for understanding people's actual behavior.
And so, yeah, that noise was the sound of my head nodding. I agree with that. I do think out of the survey we get some useful or interesting, might be the best word, information out of these, such as we saw the whole finding that a lot of things were based off of perceived familiarity. So whether something seemed familiar to them affected a lot of their attitudinals around those GTLDs. So this, I think that's what we're measuring here is not truly awareness but perceived familiarity, and we get some interesting stuff from it. But I don't expect it to correlate perfectly with actual behavior for the reasons that were stated.
And this is Jonathan. I guess the only caveat I would to Jordan's comment is that part of what we're trying to determine is consumer trust, and that perception becomes a critical part of that. It's whether they actually go to those sites or not is in some ways immaterial to whether or not they believe they would feel comfortable doing so or something. So, I mean, that's so traffic, I think data is interesting for another reason, but remember the core reason for the survey was to try and figure out a way to ask people, you know, whether they, you know, trusted the
sure, but this also gets to a point that Lorraine makes further down. It's not that interesting to ask people whether they trust something. It's interesting to ask them what they're actually doing, and this is seeing what they actually do. They could tell you they don't trust it, but then if they actually go to them all the time.
Right, but if they're unconscious, as you describe, about what they're doing, then it doesn't get to the same notion of I would be happy. The fact that I believe I go to .Berlin, whether I do or not, means more than whether or not I go because I'm going via a search engine or something,
well,
doesn't it?
It means something different, I think.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean,
I'm not saying we should get rid of this question. I'm saying we have to supplement this question with, especially where we have the data, with seeing what people actually do.
Yeah, this is Jamie. I hate to say this, but I kind of agree with Jonathan. There's two different things here. There's awareness, which does go to trust and familiarity, obviously, and then there's actual use. And the data from the traffic data would actually talk about use, whereas awareness, the responses on a survey would give us data on awareness and familiarity, apart from whether or not they actually do use it, which I think is useful.
And there's also one of the things we are trying to get is sort of the relative velocity with which the new GTLDs come in and get accepted. Yeah. Okay. So can we add the internationalized CCT DLDs where regionally relevant? We'll be doing that more in the new section. So as opposed to here, we'll be applying that to where we're testing the new GTLDs. But, yes, we will. As we've discussed, we'll do that. All right. The next one is about question 710, how likely are you to visit websites? To be honest, and the probe was, what does this help determine? Is it actionable, that kind of stuff? We didn't find this data to be very useful, and I don't think that people really navigate with intent, and it's not used to filter anything. So I would be fine with dropping this question. I think it's low value. And it's just one more hoop that we make people jump through that's a little bit conceptually different. What we saw is that if they were familiar with it or they thought they were familiar with it, they planned to go again.
This is Jonathan. I guess the example that would be interesting, but there just might not be statistically significant, is something like a dot bank where I might make an affirmative choice to go to the site because of the TLD. And because I've heard now through advertising or something that it's safer, I'm less likely to be phished by going there. I don't know how many examples there are like that and how much it's reasonable to even assume that people have heard of them at this point. Right. It's not on the list now, but I mean, I'm wondering if it's that would be the only value of that question, and that would probably be the only reason for someone to answer that question affirmatively.
Sorry, thank you. So let me make sure I've got it correctly. There's a perception that people, or there's a hypothesis that people might be more accepting or have greater level of trust, whatever you want to say, if it's a financial-related thing and it's a .bank-related domain, or it's a health-related thing and it's a .pharmacy or .hospital-related DLD. Is that the hypothesis?
Yeah, so one hypothesis. Here you're looking at legacy, I guess. Somehow my screen got expanded, and I can't see the question, only the comment. But the one hypothesis is that people trust .com, for example, more just because they're more aware of it, right? The other hypothesis is that people will have a greater degree of trust because having the word there makes it create some validation. You know, they'll assume that everybody in dot photography is a photographer or something like that, but more so in the case of something potentially well advertised or evangelized in the new GTLD space, like dot bank or something where presumably there will be a huge advertising campaign that says, trust dot bank, don't click on the link unless it says dot bank, something like that, where that explicit behavior will, in fact, be encouraged, I guess.
So Jonathan, I think, this is Jordan again, I think that's a totally reasonable hypothesis about something that doesn't exist today. Dot Bank hasn't done that yet. I do think, though, as we get further down the survey, there's the sort of trust areas, and like, I agree with what Lorien said down there, that we need to look at use cases there, and that's probably the way to draw this out, to see, like, in this specific situation, would you behave like this?
There might not be anything yet.
Right, and it might have to be hypothetical again, but I think this particular if we're worried the survey is too long, this question doesn't seem to add very much. I'd certainly be in favor of dropping it.
David Taylor, just to swim the other way on this one, because someone has to. Obviously, I think where you've got the country code, you may be looking for certain content. So, I mean, you may go to google.fr because you'll get different content if you go to google.com. So I think that may have some importance. But also I think what's interesting is, yes, you'd go to .com because that's what everybody knows, but then these are old new GTLDs next to it. So I think there's a certain aspect there where I wonder whether you'd go to a .mobi because you're on your mobile phone. Would that actually be something which has worked? So you kind of see whether these old new GTLDs have actually done anything different or whether they are, you know, redundant compared to everything else. So there's an advantage, but if you have to get rid of something, this might be one of the highest targets to get rid of.
And I think what I would hypothesize is that that dynamic probably hasn't changed a whole lot in the last year, so we have this data from the last time around. And unless we're thinking that those long-term things have changed in the past year, yeah. The sword has... So 719 is a question about that I think we would still keep in what might make them visit websites with a domain name extension you have not seen before. I might suggest that we move this a little bit later in the survey. That won't affect it. But was it triggered only by those people who said they were aware but hadn't visited them, that sort of thing? No, it wasn't. And actually, the screening for this question when I reviewed it seemed a little bit odd to me. So I think it's more what we'll keep the question, but we'll move it to where we're at the front of where we start talking about new GTLDs and just ask it as a general probe and see what we get there. And it's open-ended, so it's not really that valuable for tracking anyways. We want to get it contextual. Why do we include the 2,000 round TLDs in previous questions but not here? For the trustworthy question, I think if I had to put myself in the shoes of the questionnaire writer back then, it was just to keep it shorter and more manageable. Since this is a rating question, they have to go through each one rather than just pick from a list. So they probably truncated the list. I think there probably is some value. If you guys feel it's important, there's probably some value in keeping the list the same, but it does make the task a little bit harder for the respondent. But I would keep them the same. I wouldn't add any beyond that. So then the next question, which is more overarching, is, you know, the use of the term trustworthy. Bless you, yeah. I have two reactions here. One, I do think trustworthy is at a general level. Do people feel it's trustworthy? Yes, the specifics of what makes it trustworthy or exactly what I feel trustworthy is going to vary. But as a general measure for tracking purposes, it's fine. We want to see if the newer GTLDs increased in trust level as they become more prevalent. Now, based as it was mentioned earlier, would we get different results if we specified use cases? I'm sorry, say again? Yeah. And we definitely would. I've seen that in research. Nielsen's seen that in research. My own experience from doing a project not too long ago, small sample size, qualitative, but was, you know, big difference between people's level of concern about healthcare versus financial. Much, much more concern about finance than health in the U.S. there were groans. Adding some use cases, I think, could help expand our understanding of what trustworthiness is for these. It greatly adds to the complexity. So I'm happy to do it, but we need to look at ways to maybe further economize in other areas. So it's how much you value. I would keep this question as is, though, because it's going to be the only thing we have that's comparable on this topic.
And this is Laureen, the person who suggested that. So I have no objection to the question, but I do think it's important that we measure the behavior for the very reason you stated, that you know, people are inclined to say, oh, yeah, I trust it, but I'm not going to give my credit card number to it. And, you know, so it's just a much more objective, useful, additional bit of information. So I understand that we're going to have to weigh some things, and maybe we can talk about it more specifically at some point about what would be a realistic way to move forward.
Yeah, and so what I'm sensitive to that, and what I would suggest we do is rather than try and measure it as a relative aspect of one TLD against another, I would frame a question later on when we're more into the trust section about behavior, because it varies by use case, but it also varies by individual. There are some people who won't put anything personal out there, won't even have a Facebook page, and there are some people who, I don't care, you know. So,
it's Jordan again. So as I've alluded to earlier, I agree strongly with Lorraine on the overall point here. I do think, we're going to be in a little bit of a conundrum as we think about the survey and the desire for comparability versus the desire for useful data for the purposes of the review. And I think what we probably want to do is figure out a relatively small set of questions where we think comparability is really important, and we expect that there might have been changes over the past year, because it's a relatively limited period of time as well, and then use the rest of the sort of space that we have available in terms of number of questions that we can ask people to make sure we're getting at the right questions to give us the data that we think we really need in order to make decisions as a review team. So I don't think, unfortunately, that's a little bit more of a complex exercise than we're going to get through today, but something that we've proposed internally as a review team is to get a small number of us to work directly with Nielsen to try to hone this. So maybe today we can get through a run-through and understand the high-level issues, and then a few of us can maybe work directly with you and figure out how to make those trade-offs, because I think we are going to totally understand the point that we want comparability, totally understand the point we can't ask 7,000 questions. Therefore, we probably need to focus where we're getting comparability and jettison some of the other stuff in favor of the questions that we really need to get to.
And just to make it a little more complex, there is also, I'll throw out the option if we're going to have an ongoing discussion about this, there is also the option of being willing to trade off some statistical reliability for flexibility. So you could split the sample, have half the people answer questions that we want comparability on, but we're willing to trade off analysis down at the country level or something like that, just look at it from roll-ups, and ask the other half a new question that we don't need to have asked of everyone, but we want to get a finger in the wind kind of thing. So that's a possibility we can discuss. So 727, what was it that made it more trustworthy? And there was a suggestion to tie this to behavior. I think what we've got a number of questions we're trying to add later in the survey that try and get at some of the behavioral elements. So hopefully we could do that at that point rather than here. We didn't get hugely valuable stuff out here, but we did get some interesting things here, and I think it would be nice to keep this as an open end comparable from one wave to the other. Uh, 753, there was just a question why we were making this transition at this point in time. Again, trying to channel the efforts of the previous writer, I would guess that they felt it was more specific here. Some of the earlier stuff was more generally about navigating to websites, and the language was a little less specific, and here is where we started to drill down into the topic of GTLDs specifically. So I think they just felt that it was a point in the study to take a break, focus them in on something. The next question, 755, there was a question about the word extreme. Not sure how this will be interpreted or defined. We batted around questions. How this is used is this is where we created our word clouds and contrasted the perceptions of the existing GTLDs with the new GTLDs and to see what were the differences. Were we introducing perceptions that there were too many or it was confusing or those sorts of things? I went and looked at this data, and while there are variations by country, they're systematic. They're not linked to individual. The rank ordering of the words tends to be the same from country to by and large, country to country. So in one country, Nigeria, for example, they tended to say all of these except confusing described. You know, they were higher selection, whereas in the U.S., more variation. So you see those sort of typical response patterns, but there weren't any it didn't appear to be there any significant differences in interpretation, and I judge that because the patterns tended to be the same. From my point of view, extreme, I don't know how it would be specifically interpreted, but I would just keep it the same so we have the same set of adjectives to look at. What we saw from this last time is that there weren't really overwhelming negative perceptions of either the existing or the new ones, but there was an elevation of some of the more negative ones for the new ones, and we want to see if that tails down.
So, David here. I was just going to say, there's not many negative comments in there, though, are there, of the 15?
Confusing, overwhelming. Unconventional, you could say that's good or bad, and technical, you could say is good or bad. So, yeah, but they are,
I agree. It's more positive.
Uh, 765, there was a comment about not sure that the average Joe or Jane will understand purchasing. This is not a question that we will get rid of just because we're dropping the registrant data. We still want to get the general population's viewpoint about this. I tend to agree with you, and this was one of the areas when I was presenting the results last year. People kept saying, what do you mean by restrictions, those sorts of things. What we have elected to do is keep the question for comparability, but this is where we've added follow-on questions to try and get better data about the level of acceptance of different types of restrictions. So, and that's lower on this page, question 767. We gave examples of some restrictions and asked them whether they thought those were appropriate. The comment here was maybe dot builder's not restrictive enough. My thought here is, I mean, we could either change it to a more restrictive one, or we could have two. If we thought that there was going to be a meaningful difference, we could add a response option that would be something finance or healthcare related, banks or pharmacy, something like that. Yeah, pharmacy was one of the suggestions in here. You wouldn't want to navigate to a dot pharmacy site and see somebody selling life insurance or funeral plans, those sorts of things. Yeah. Okay, so I think then. Unless I see heads nodding the other direction, we'll add a fourth option in here that'll be pharmacy. And so we'll work up some language for that. Okay, so question 800 is where we present them with a list of newer GTLDs, and we start asking them questions about it. The first comment is what we've already talked about. We will add here, we will add a country-specific city level, real or anticipated. And about including the internationalized GTLDs or CCTLDs, I think that's a similar question. We can add, China gets a couple of extra responses here, a couple of internationalized, they show up as Chinese characters in the survey, internationalized GTLDs. And if there's a desire to add some of those in other countries, we can do that because it's only affecting the people in the, those countries, so we're not making the list just exponentially longer for everyone. The other question was, how did we get at this list? Our understanding is a year ago they looked at the ones that had gotten the largest number of registrations, and that's how we picked. We have then supplemented the list with all that had 100,000 or more registrations as of a couple of weeks ago, I think was the data I had gotten. So we've made the list longer. And this is where, you know, again, we had this discussion last year. What we're not necessarily looking for here is parity with .com. We're looking for uptake, sort of something that's going to indicate that the affinity model is working. Yeah.
So this is Jordan again. I think the number of registrations is maybe not the right metric for a filter here. Like I look at that science, for example, that has a lot of registrations because they've been selling it really cheaply. I have never seen a .science URL in use anywhere in the wild, whereas several of these other ones I have because people actually use those because they paid money to get them. So we may want to look at like what are the, you know, what TLDs are most, of the new TLDs are most common in the Alexa 10,000 or something, like just like where are their actual sites as opposed to where are their registrations, I think would be a more useful metric to see how people are perceiving these.
Excuse me, it's Megan Richards with Eric. I had asked also that for .Berlin, you extend that to the European Union. You can add Turkey as well if you like. But I think it's unusual to ask only in Germany for .Berlin. It's not quite like .London, obviously. But if it has traction, it will be far beyond Germany in principle.
This is only
you say that's not true of .London or .Paris?
Well, you didn't ask for .Paris. You asked for .London,
yeah,
and you asked .London only if you're in Italy, Turkey, Spain, Poland, UK, France, and Germany, which I think is perfectly legitimate. But for Berlin, OVH you can ask only the Germans. But Berlin, .Berlin, I think would have greater traction in most of Europe. So you could... Exactly. So my argument only was that you should ask that question to all those in Europe, plus Turkey if you want. You can add Turkey as well. It will give you a good comparison, too, between the differences between .London and .Berlin. And it doesn't change the question. It just expands the audience.
Yeah, it's reasonable, except I'm wading through. Now that we've got a city-specific code, a CCTLD for each country in Europe, then if we apply that rule to Madrid, Rome, everything, then everyone in the EU now all of a sudden has a significantly longer list. It's going to be a list of...
That's not what you're asking, according to this. You're asking only Berlin? And
yeah,
Berlin?
So but we're making a modification. That we agreed to make a modification that we'd have a city code for every country. That was the list we looked at.
So now London will only show in the UK, Berlin will only show in Germany, Madrid will show in Spain.
If you're changing that, then that's fine.
Okay.
We don't want to discriminate between London and Berlin. Good.
Okay, 805, we've already talked about it. It's the browsing data. 812, this is one of the new questions we answered to kind of give an experiential thing of to test if the structure changes the intent to visit. And their question was, are we planning to translate these? We had an internal discussion. What we suggested that we do is keep four English language versions and then add a translated version as a fifth option. So that way we're consistently testing the structure, but also then testing a localization as factors in getting them to change their willingness or affecting their likelihood to go. So that's what we suggested. The second comment there, keeping the same structure as .com, agreed. That's fine. We'll modify that. Okay, I'm not seeing any concerns about that, so we'll move on. And so there was a suggestion about a use case sort of, additional use case sort of thing. Imagine you were looking for something in Berlin. So what we did here was the first question was sort of topical information search. The second one was purchase or commerce related. We could add a third question that would be sort of travel. We could talk about it as travel or cultural related type thing. Same structure, but just frame it the way it's suggested there and just add that question. So we think this is a valuable area to explore to get some better data, and so we're fine with adding that one question in there. 831, we can do that. We'll just make that country-specific, which example. What we did here is we gave them a generalized set of examples. We'll just make it specific.
This is Jonathan. You asked a conditional if you were planning to register a domain. Is the actual question about whether they're going to? Did that get removed earlier with registrants?
Yes, that's. You're right. Sorry, I didn't catch that. This question is now gone because we decided to get rid of all the registrant questions. We'll ask this in the registrant survey.
I mean, I guess a question for the group: is it worth having one question in there that gets a sense of percentage of consumers that are registrants? Oh, as part of the screening on the other one, we'd get it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we can track how many people bail, get cut from the
right,
survey.
Right, right, right. Okay, thank you.
And we have it from last time as well, so it probably hasn't changed hugely. So again, on the issue, we would like to keep the question as is for comparability. We're adding some questions. We will update this list, however, to match the same changes we made in the earlier list, which was question 805. So the list will change, so the structure is the same. We'll keep the general question about asking them their perception of trustworthiness. Question 848, this question's now gone. It was only asked of people who had registered, and we'll have that in the registrant survey. A55, a repeat of the same question, but we're gonna leave it as is. First thing, we will update this list to match question 805, so it'll be consistent there. Seems weird that we don't have a TLD that registrants might strongly associate with restriction. I'm jumping back to that list just to see if that's changed. Unless the Alexa analysis changes that.
I think definitionally you would expect a smaller number of registrations and restricted TLDs than non-restricted TLDs. So you'd have to, like the dot pharmacy example is maybe another good thing. I don't know. Choose one that actually exists that you might expect people to expect restrictions on.
Yeah, so I guess what we can do is we can update this list to mirror the other changes and then supplement it a little further with .bank and .pharmacy. Correct.
So this is Jamie. Does it? I'm not sure that .bank has been delegated. I'm not sure. I don't know anything about .pharmacy. Does that matter?
For the purposes of this survey, not really.
Right.
The only way it would matter if somebody said, and it's inconsequential really, is if somebody said, "Oh, I've never heard of .pharmacy. Let me see if I can find one." You know. They are online when they do this, but it's inconsequential. We'll come back and talk about the comment on D910, I think. I'll take it back. We'll go ahead and talk about it here. So this is in the section where, as we were talking earlier, I think we'll add a generalized question about their comfort level in different use scenarios. So for general navigation, providing some form of personal information, such as, providing health information, those sorts of things, and see what their general level of comfort is to that. We'll work on that. I don't have a specific structure for that yet, but we'll add something here. And frankly, on the next comment about what's the difference between a couple of these options, I have a hard time saying what the differences are myself. I think I can interpret what was intended to be there, but I don't think it's – if I have to stretch to do it, the respondent's not going to parse that out very well. So this would be a question where the data was not particularly useful last time around. Either we say we don't really need this question, or we change the response options to something that's going to be useful. And the other question, we give consumers what they're thinking. The question was, does that mean registrants? I think the intent was consumer protection, but it's not clear. So none of these are good response options. So. Does this question in general, if we fix the options, does this question have any real value? You say, yeah? Okay. So what we'll do is, if there's any specific suggestions, I'm happy to hear them. Otherwise, we'll draft up a new set of response options and put those out for quick approval.
This is Jordan. I do think if we're going to have a small group that works with you guys, that it would be good to understand what we're looking to understand in this question. So we probably ought to pitch something to you in terms of, like, at least what types of behaviors we're trying to understand.
That's wonderful from my standpoint. I just know some people, sometimes it's easier if I throw out a straw man and people react to it. So either way. But if you can get something to me expeditiously, to use a big word, I'd be happy.
David Taylor, I was just wondering there, because if we're seeking to measure trust and also, I suppose, expectations of consumers, I wonder whether we could put in some examples of, if you go to mayor.london, what do you expect to see? If you go to whistler.ski, what do you expect to see? If you go to bordeaux.wine, what do you expect to see? Sort of examples like that, and even then, I don't know whether we can go to barclays.bank. Do you expect to see Barclays there, or whether we should actually name banks and brands? But, on .film, what would you see at .film if you went to jamesbond.film or ebay.film? Would you expect that? So there might be something we can fish out there from examples.
What you're proposing are a series of open-ended questions, which would add it'd be great to hear, would add substantially to the length. and also the complexity because we have to manually code the responses to those. But, I mean, you could... I don't know if something like, if you know, would you be more likely to visit jamesbond.com versus jamesbond.film? You know, that you could get, you know, predilection, but getting the whys, it's going to be out of scope of the survey at this point unless we can find other ways to really cut it. Yeah, even though it would be great information to have. Yeah. It would be nice to... I try never to sell additional research in a meeting like this, but if there you wanted to, you could call some people from the results and add a short follow-on, just a small subset of people, you'd give them an extra incentive, and you could get some sound bites from them written, or there are ways to gather them audio as well. Or you could do a focus group, but I think you could just... streaming people out of this survey, you could do a little follow-on research to get that. So, you know. For something like that where you're trying to elucidate the quality of the responses and the sorts of themes that come up, you don't need the sample sizes that we've got here. You just need a small subset of the people you talk to. And so we could, based on their responses, we could stream some people out, give them an extra incentive, and have them... do a little follow-on.
Carlos Gutierrez for the record. This is a question for the group. Now that we are in this segment of registrants and trusting the registrants, and again, it's only a question, shouldn't we ask the people if they trust the way they are going to handle their personal data in the registration? I don't want to mention the two words, who is behind it.
Yeah, I wrote that down as one of the potential response options. I think that's a good thing. Yeah. So the next question, 915, little bit further ahead. There you go.
I'll just stop you now. Just clarity. I thought we were dropping everything about registrants.
We're dropping all the questions that are specifically about people who have registered. This question is about a consumer's perception that the entities that register are taking precautions. Precautions to protect PCI, you know, those sorts of things. So it's a gray area. It overlaps, but since some of the original things were intended to be going down the line of if I register a dot pharmacy, that it is somebody who's legitimately involved in the pharmaceutical business in some way. You know, it was that sort of thing. It wasn't so much about
back off again.
Thank you.
It's Jonathan. If I'm asking somebody who isn't or doesn't plan to register a domain how they feel about the people that register them, in other words, about registrants or about registrars, I guess maybe that's the question I'm asking. Is it? In other words, how do I feel about the people that buy domains in, is that what you mean?
It's a very good point. We're asking a question that's perception of the registrars, essentially, the entities who do the registration.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
And
so is there value to you? If we get that in the registrant survey, do we care what the larger population thinks about that? In some areas we might because there's a general perception of that the trustworthiness of the sites cascades from that process, but this question
if they haven't engaged in the process. I mean, I guess I have a related question that might affect this, which is what was the length of the registrant survey, or do we have more flexibility there? Because I'm wondering if what might come up in some of these conversations is that we ask a few additional questions for the people that say no on the registrant survey to kind of get at why. I mean, I know that some folks in ALEC are interested about other forms of online identity, Facebook, things like that. Do you have one of those instead? How do you feel about registrars? I mean, maybe a reason that somebody doesn't do it. Can you have a set of questions that you ask a different branch off of a qualifying question that's a much shorter branch, I guess, is what I mean, and is the survey, I guess that wouldn't add to the length of the survey because it would be a different group of people. So the people that said they aren't or aren't planning to be registrants, getting at why, there might be a few questions there, and that might be a place for this.
So regarding the length of the registrant survey, I don't have that data with me. I'm going to guess it wasn't that much different, but some of the changes here, I suspect it was a little bit shorter, and some of the changes we're making here won't be impactful there. So I'm going to say that we probably do have flexibility. I'll validate that, but we probably do have flexibility in that survey to delve on some of these issues. And this specific question, now that I think about it in the context of your question, I think this is much more of a registrant question. The next question is sort of more the consumer opinion.
It could also be a reason you're not a registrant.
Well, exactly, yeah.
But it's more for that survey.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Well, except now keep in mind in that survey, the people who get in it are people who have registered. So if I don't trust
that's,
the industry.
That's the question I'm asking. So let me ask that question again. The question you're asking about who gets in it, is it possible to ask a few questions of the people who ordinarily wouldn't get in it?
You have a separate
branch like that.
Yeah, if somebody disqualifies, they haven't ever registered, we could ask a follow-on question that is, why haven't you? No need, don't trust the industry, et cetera. And a couple of questions. There'd be a slight incremental cost to do that, but it's minor, given that it's only a few questions and there's a little bit of data processing. So.
There's a comment in the chat from Kylie, and I just wanted to read it out loud. He said, I expect that end users would care more about the website's trustworthiness instead of the domain's name for their awareness. Thus, asking questions about trusting a GTLD name would be hard to answer for most end users, especially individual end users. So I think it's getting back to that use case question.
Yeah, and you know, how do we, within the myriad of .com websites, how do we judge which ones have implicit trustworthiness versus others? I think that's a bigger task than what we can do here. I think there's validity to the comment. I think what we're looking for here is just, does the extension seem to have a significant impact on these perceptions? And if the answer is no, that's the answer. Yeah. It would be an interesting thing to figure out how people – I've got 10 search results, which one I consider to be more trustworthy, if any. But
whichever one Google ranks higher, I think, is the answer to that.
Question 915 – There were a couple of comments. Country-specific examples for Internet service providers. I'm not sure who put that in, so we're thinking about whoever provides your Internet connection or something like that. We can generalize the language a little bit. That's not an issue. I think this is a question that we would like to keep as much similar as possible because there was a nice piece of data that came out of here that this industry fared much better than the other entities in this question, and would want to make sure that hasn't changed at all, unless we don't care, unless we say, yeah, you know, it's going to probably be the same answer, and then let's ask something different. But my bias would be to keep it. Then there was a suggestion about adding which registrar they recognize most. That would be, I think if we were going to add that, it would be for the registrant survey as opposed to this survey. Also, I would be concerned it might be a political issue, but I'll leave that to you guys. I'm the outsider. Uh, 1005 agreed. Good suggestion. We'll do it. Same for 1020. So that's we'll add an example of a URL shortener. I'll create a bit.ly address and use that. And we'll add a sample QR code. I'll figure out which one to stick in there. One of my boarding passes or something like that. So 1035. We actually expanded this list somewhat from last time. The question is use cases, you know, and different ways of going at it. Definitely agree that it likely varies based on use case. And so it's just the overall complexity of trying to parse out all those different use cases. If there were a couple of key use cases, such as information search, shopping, financial information, health information. I could turn this into a matrix question potentially and get at that at a high level to see if they think that one of these ways is, you know, maybe I would expect app probably scores higher for bank than just generally, you know, that sort of thing. So I'm seeing some heads nod around that. I'll see what I can do there. I think it would be interesting to, well, I have two responses here. This is question 1040. How often do you remember the address so you can type it in? Probably, I struggle with this question because am I remembering the address if I have it bookmarked, if it's on my favorites bar? How often is this really? I'm not sure exactly what we're really trying to get at here. We can add questions, but it's length. We're just that length issue, and I'm not sure that this question is valuable enough to add a follow-on question.
Do you mean? Sorry, hold on here. Do you mean address as in the numeric? Address or the...
I think they mean the URL, yeah.
The URL?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, if anyone remembers the numeric address, I'd be very impressed.
I think it would be worthwhile to leave it. We had an interesting discussion yesterday about whether people actually type and whether people actually remember that it's stans.com or stans.biz or whatever, and whether if you switched to .biz from .com or .mobi or .bank, whatever, people would actually pick that up. So I think it would be valuable to leave it.
So I agree with what you're saying, Hal. I don't think that we're going to get that from this question. I do think we may want to think about, whether we want to get data from, like, user studies or something like that. That would be more – it would be interesting to say, like, to give someone a domain like bigshot.photography and see what they actually – like, tell them that name or show it to them and then see what they actually type into their browser. I think that would actually be really interesting to see. I don't think how often you remember the name of the website that you're going to go to is going to really tell us that particular bit of behavior. I would be surprised, I guess, if this is changing over time as well. So I think last year's – I actually really like the idea of the matrix in the previous question, and I think if we have a few use cases, that will actually get to the segmentation that's proposed here as well, like if banking's there versus like a more casual site, like maybe people do remember the URL more often in some key sites like that, but not with like random, you know, restaurant you want to go to or something.
Well, I think it's also autofills, do you actually validate that it's the actual address? And there's a social bias to say, oh, of course I do that. But the actual behavior is probably much lower than that. I type the first three letters and hit enter.
Yeah, I mean, part of the autofill is blurs the distinction between guessing and searching is the problem. Because I think it's a valid hypothesis that this enormous expansion of TLDs will lead to less guessing. But the actual act of guessing versus searching has become identical.
Yeah, this is Jeremy. The only way I think we would figure this out is to do user studies as opposed to a user survey. That's a much more intensive exercise, and we couldn't do nearly as many people, but it still may be like we'd want to work with ICANN to do that and see, like ask people to do tasks and see what they actually do.
One thing we could do, I'll throw this out. I mean, my bias is to just get rid of the question, but we could structure the question along the lines of suppose, think about a website that that's important to you, you visit regularly. How do you navigate there? I bookmark it. I start typing and let autofill. I type the entire name. Maybe there's another behavior I haven't thought of, but, you know, you could give
use a search engine.
Use a search engine, yeah. enter a general term into a search engine, you know, those sorts of things, and see what they say they do for those things. But again, how accurate is that behavior actually going to be? And don't we know already that things that are important to them, they're going to have some sort of mechanism, bookmarking or autocomplete or something to do it anyway. So I'm not sure that it really gives us anything we don't know. Do you want your mic on? There's a sidebar discussion going on.
This is Jonathan. It sounds like the consensus might be to drop the question. Lisa, as a separate thing, as we come up with these brainstorm ideas for additional research exercises, it's probably worth making note to bring them up with the trust team when that happens. So like a side note of user testing in one case, and what was the other thing that we just discussed today is already another type of getting browsing data, right, where was the other thing that you're already aware of, Lisa.
A comment on 1045 was, is this redundant? The intent here was to get self-reported change in behavior. Am I doing something different than I was 3 years ago? We're making that earlier question a matrix question. I don't want to repeat a full matrix for this. It would have to be generalized if we keep it. I will also hypothesize, we didn't see a lot of change. The little bit of change we saw was as expected, and I strongly believe that it was underreporting actual change. So I'm not sure that this question is really giving you anything other than people's perception that of the rate of change in their own behavior, which is minimal value in my point of view. Drop it? Okay. Question 1100, there was a suggestion to simplify these. I looked at these, didn't readily see a way to simplify them without the potential of being misleading, and this is a tracking question, so would suggest we just leave them the same.
And this is Aliza. I just wanted to add, these were definitions we came up with the implementation advisory group, with the small group that we worked with to vet the first instance of this survey. So that's where these definitions came from.
So the next was 1111. General comment about the value of this information. What we learned last time was basically that it was law enforcement's response. All of these tended to be law enforcement's responsibility rather than ICANN's responsibility. That probably, you know, I don't have an hypothesis that that's going to have changed much. So, again, we're adding a number of questions. Unless people see value in replicating that result, I would go ahead and drop this, especially since there were some, you know, I think people are online. So if they don't know who ICANN is, they can go look it up. So it's the innate response versus the learned response is potentially different for this question. So I think it may overinflate a little bit the ICANN responses that we did get, and generally we did see that it was overwhelmingly seemed to be criminal activity, and that those entities in one form or another should take on the responsibility.
I mean, I think law enforcement is often involved in these problems, but there's also a lot of sort of industry activity and self-regulation that happens here that's just not reflected here at all. And I don't know if people know that or not. I don't know what we would do with this information. Like,
stop like, doing it.
People, but, like, we're going to continue, like, certainly on the cybersecurity front, I would imagine that, like, we're not going to change the strategy based on what people think here. Yeah, so this doesn't seem like a useful question to me.
Great. It's gone. So the next one was 1125. How scared? Scared seems like a charged word. It probably was selected, to measure fear. It's a popular meme that, scary things happen on the Internet, that people some people say you should be afraid. So we wanted to measure that. And we got some interesting stuff out of this, that the more exposure I had actually to some of these behaviors, the less afraid I was of them. And I've actually seen that in the real world with IT directors who, once they've had a spear phishing attack in their organization, they seem to be even less concerned about it because they get inured to it or they have overcome it, those sorts of things. So, scared is a charged word, but I would leave it there for that information and just see whether we're seeing any directional trends in the level of fear. Seven seventy-five. Yeah. We can amend this list specifically for national base. I think that was the intent of some of these categorizations, but we can expand this list if there's a feeling that something's missing. And again, with all of these, I would ask how valuable the information was to you. I'm trying to remember the results from this. I think primarily it was they would contact the web, or that was very high response was contact the website owner, which I thought was potentially naive.
More and more countries have incident response centers, but I don't know if they are geared to the final user or more geared against protecting against denial of service attacks and things like that. I don't know what the awareness is of the people of these national centers that combine police and judiciary and government IT people, etc.
I gotta imagine that cross-jurisdictional groups like that are probably not very well known outside of the industry. We could certainly add it as an option, but all right, we're down into the closing things here. We've got some things in the demographics for each country. Why is illiterate here in India? Since it's online, if they're illiterate, I'm not sure how they're completing the survey. So it's probably just was a stock response. So get rid of it. I think the next ones were in Brazil. So 1507 about education classifications within Brazil, comment that this was incorrect or outdated. Our team is going back to the Nielsen Standards Group to make sure that they haven't updated this, but whoever made this comment would love to get the classification that you think is current so that we can contrast that with whatever Nielsen has.
Sorry, but isn't your nanum the same as your illiterate in the other one? In question 1507.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Brazilian.
Good. Didn't realize that was in everywhere. I thought that was just India. Yeah. The next one, we don't need to, we can change the currency designation there. So that's it. For all. So I think the action steps at this point are obviously for me to go through and clean up this version based on what we've talked about here. I think there was the offer to give me a straw man on whatever question that was. Now a set of response options for I can find it again. I'll do that. But if I don't have that by the time I've cleaned that up, I'll just send a straw man of my own down. I think we got rid of that question after we had that discussion, now that I think about that. So I'll validate that. And then one more pass-through with a look towards, as it was suggested, anything else that's really considered to be critical for tracking, and if there's anything else we can possibly drop out, because we are going to be adding a fair amount, and then get it into the field as quickly as possible.
This is Jonathan, I know Karen wants to talk. Two questions. One is about is there some data significance to the time of year or something like that the survey is fielded? That's why you said you wanted to be close to the time last year. And I ask that in context because the group had talked about trying to, convene again fairly quickly, but to really nail down if there was anything else that they wanted to try and get out of this. And I don't know if we've resolved all those questions or if we still want to do that. So that's my question to the group. But what is the parameters on your concerns about the timing?
So avoiding any major holiday periods, Chinese New Year's passed now, so we avoided that. And we're still basically in winter time. So I would say as long as we get it out by early March, I'm pretty confident. Once you get into springtime, people's activity patterns start to change. Probably not going to have a huge impact, but I would still, especially as people are increasingly ubiquitous all the time, Internet citizens. But the sooner we can do it, the better. But I'd say, you know, if we can get out by early March, that would be good.
So this is Jonathan. This is a question then for the group. After the discussion today, is there still an interest in trying to create a sub-team to make further modifications or add additional questions based on the conversation today? And if so, can we turn around that internal conversation, you know, within the next week, basically? So how do people feel? I guess just raise your hand if you would think that there ought to be further kibitzing from within the team. He's already planning to do that, but I think if we want to have proactive input and not reactive input, we need to form a group to work in parallel to whatever he's doing in order to get it done in a reasonable time frame. So there's enough people that raise their hand that I guess we'll try very, very quickly to do another pass at this and converse about potential additions or something like that and get those to you as well.
And are those hands the members who'd like to be on that small working group? Could you raise your hands again? Sorry.
If you're willing to be on this group, on that group. Yeah.
So I see Carlos, David, Jordan, maybe. Jordan, Jonathan. Megan, did I see your hand or no? Okay.
Yeah. It's like that Far Side cartoon with the rifle scope and the bear is pointing to the other bear.
So we'll include this small group in correspondence with David.
Okay, great. And Karen, go ahead. Sorry.
Thanks, Jonathan. This was just raise something that Kylie had suggested in the chat a while ago, a few questions up, but and maybe this is something that the small group could do, but his suggestion was to look at the definition that we have of consumer trust in the terms of reference and sort of track the questionnaire against each of those elements and whether that accounts, how it accounts for all of the elements of consumer trust that we agreed on. So.
Jonathan, let's take that in the sub-team. And identify yourself.
Carlton Samuels, for the record. A couple of the questions that were asked in which we're going to refine the list actually went down to the trust issue. So when those are complete, we'll have a better sense of whether or not we hit the mark. So I would wait until those are refined.
Okay, anything else today? All right, thanks. Thanks for joining us.
So we had a break scheduled for after Dave's presentation, but we finished early. So extra long break or 15-minute break, perhaps?
I'm still on a break, but I keep
yeah.
the same lane.
Okay.
We'll probably need to time.
Yeah. So
I think we want to do, as the last guest of yesterday's discussion. Sorry.
This is Jonathan. One of the things we want to do is go over Jordan's categorization
Wait.
Of the sub-teams for the first part of the review, the application process part of the review, and then have everybody kind of sign up for what part of that they're willing to read the reports on. We need to identify the whatever additional resources will be part of that, and I think we then hit pause on that based on Stan's suggestion yesterday, but at least identify those things and then jump into the sub-team work that we're going to do in the other areas.
Okay.
So let's do that right after the break.
So let's meet back at 10:30 and talk about that, and then at 10:45 we have our next briefing with three more staff members coming in.
Perfect.
Thank you. think we have everyone now. So I put the categories from Jordan's email into the notes section of the Adobe Connect room.
Sorry, welcome back, everyone. This is Jonathan Zook, your late night CCT DJ. Now we're going to be talking about, we're going to be taking callers to find out who's interested in different aspects of the review. This is Laureen from Washington, D.C. What is your CCT review request? All right. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so this doesn't need to be a long, drawn-out thing. What is the easiest thing? At least is it just have people raise their hands or something like that, maybe? So it's in the notes section right here. I need to scroll down to it. So everybody saw the work that Jordan did last night after dinner. So let's first thank Jordan for doing his homework. Thank you very much. And I think the attempt there was to kind of normalize the number of pages that you would be reading out of the 200-page report. And so let's just go through them one by one and find out who wants to do which ones. So the first one was Section 1, the application processing, and Section 5, the transition to delegation. So who's interested in that team?
So I have Carlton and Carlos.
Okay. Anyone else for that?
And we also, Kylie, Calvin, and Drew, you can either raise your hands or type into the chat which group you'd like to join.
Okay. Then the second one is just Section 2, application evaluation, because that's a big one. So who's interested in that?
Fabro's all alone?
They're in the notes section. They're in the notes section of the Adobe Connect.
Carlson, you too.
You need to scroll down to the bottom, maybe.
And Fabro here, if there's still time, would like to volunteer for the new sub-team group as well.
Yes, I'll add you to that. And Kylie just noted he wants to join the competition sub-team. Kylie, we're focused on the application and evaluation process, and there are these four sections in the notes pod that we're going through that Jordan divided up based on the program implementation report. So if there's a particular section of that, of these four that you're interested in, please pick one, or two, or three, or four.
This is Jonathan. This is the section of the review we all said we would do together. So you will end up on one of these teams. So I'm just thought I'd put that out there if you want to go revise your answer about the first two sections. Together. That's right. So we're dividing up for a part of it, but everybody's participating because it's kind of our exactly.
So for letter B, which is section two, application evaluation, I have Fabro and Carlton. Anyone else?
So Carlton signed up twice.
Oh, I'm sorry, Calvin. And
that's
Stan.
100 pages of reading. Yeah. All right. So then the next section is section three, the objection procedures and contention resolution.
I'm going to volunteer some. Don't worry, it's me.
Oh,
we've got a lot of them, since we have to be on one.
So I have Jamie, David, Megan, Dijon, Laureen, and Watto.
Okay. And then the next section is applicant support, continuing operations instrument, and program management. So there isn't really a thematic through line there. I think it was just a combination of page counts. So, but all right. So who would like to volunteer for that group? I mean, applicant support obviously is something that's important to a lot of folks in the. Okay, so we have how I'm happy to be on whichever one has the least number of people, so I can be on that one as well.
And Drew volunteered too, because it looks lonely.
Exactly. Thank you, Drew. So now, Lisa, you need to out the people that haven't volunteered. Well, no, there's a couple that only have two.
Well, A and D only have three. So do you have a preference between A and D, Jordan?
Who else besides Jordan? Which one did Jamie sign up for? Because I remember him asserting
Jamie
yesterday, volunteered. I'm a part of this team. I remember that very distinctly.
Jamie volunteered for C. Do you care either way, Jordan?
So A or D, application process.
I'll be on A.
Okay. Hang on a second.
Okay, so
Kylie goes to B, and Jordan goes to A.
Excellent. And we have everyone. So then the other question was about the other resources in addition to just this report for each of these. And the two things that were raised yesterday, one was the Ombudsman's report. And so remind me what that contained and which of these sections it applies to.
It's Megan Richards for the record. Well, the Ombudsman did a report. Well, he's done all sorts of reports, of course, but he did one in particular on the process and procedures for the community application. And he found that there were a number of procedures that could be improved in a future round. He didn't find that there was a miscarriage of justice, which he doesn't find anyway, but that there were a number of areas that could be improved. And the GAC has discussed this. Now, somewhere, and I don't have it in my access here, but somewhere I have a copy of that Ombudsman's report, and he came to speak to the GAC about it. You remember that, perhaps. But so that's something that I think, as a background for the community applications, could be very useful to have a look at.
That's one of our verticals, right?
Exactly.
So that's the should we just get a couple of people to focus on that document rather than having everybody read it?
It's an ombudsman's own initiative report. That's
is that all it is, though? Is it just about C? I mean, that's the question I was asking.
I keep losing my thing.
Sorry, this is Jamie. I think it's CPE. But
It is.
Okay, then Group C is reading that. And then the other thing that Jordan brought up yesterday as well, which is the reconsideration request, might be informative here as well. Is it a possible exercise to divide those up based on these sections?
So I had a maybe first pass that we could ask staff to do, which is to create like a short summary of each reconsideration request related to the GTLD program. And like characterize what the nature of the objection was, and then we could look and see which buckets we thought they related to.
And Jamie's volunteered.
No, I.
Oh, sorry.
So two things. One, that's a ton of work because there were a lot of reconsideration requests. Number two, reconsideration requests are getting reformed as part of the CCWG accountability proposal. So I wonder to what extent that going through all those in detail will be really helpful.
I think the idea wasn't to assess the process of reconsideration, but to use that as a way to identify areas here that people express concerns about, just to add to the list. So there might be some cursory way to just determine which of them are applicable to this exercise and then let people in those sections actually be the ones to read those actual reconsiderations, as opposed to a comprehensive summary like we do with public comments or something. Jordan, go ahead and elaborate.
Yeah. I mean, I think, Jamie, the idea is not that we want staff to necessarily have to go back and revisit each of the reconsideration requests, but presumably, hopefully there's someone who worked on them or remembers them and could just write like a sentence saying like, this was about, these people didn't like the results of their CPE request or, you know, whatever the nature of the objection is. And like Jonathan says, the idea is not that, I think in most cases, I mean, I've read a lot of the reconsideration requests, and I think generally that they were well decided. I think the idea is not that we're trying to go back and second guess the reconsideration requests. It's that we want to understand where the pain points were. And often people will have complained about things that the staff or the board behaved entirely appropriately, but it's because of maybe a flaw or perceived deficiency in the guidebook or the policy, and that's exactly what we want to identify.
Carlos, before we go that far, Jordan, I think we have to check if the reconsideration requests were accepted or not, because the typical response is that they are not accepted. So I would say to any reconsideration that was accepted, we should analyze what you are suggesting.
No, but that's my whole point.
Analyze all of them.
Right. Is in many of these cases, the staff did exactly what they should have done under the policy, and people complained anyways. And it is useful, but it's useful for us to understand what people were complaining about, because that might imply there should be a different policy, and that's what we're trying to figure out.
This is Jamie. So you just want a one-sentence summary of the issue, and then you have an analysis that says 47 people filed reconsideration requests of CPE, for example.
Right, and then then the CPE group could go and read those.
Team members might then go to the ones that were categorized in a certain way and look at them as the point.
Yeah, so we'll take it back and figure out how to manage that. But it sounds like it shouldn't be as hard as what we initially thought. So.
The public comment matrix for the CCWG.
David Taylor, and just wondering, I'm not following on the reconsideration request, could we do the same on CEP and IRPs? Again, very high level. Because I think just to look at reconsideration requests in isolation might not be so worthwhile. CEP, yeah.
Okay, yeah, we'll come back with what's doable.
Terrific, thank you. So then, so my only other question, sorry? I will. The only thing I want to ask briefly is, those were the two resources I remember from yesterday that people thought might be useful to this particular exercise. Are there others that anyone can think of before we leave this topic, which we're going to do shortly, so. Okay. Great. So to summarize, Carlton, we've divided into little sub-teams on this portion of the review based on these taking these sections, and it's going to be the responsibility of those teams to go read that section of the or sections of the implementation review and to read it with attention to the vertical concerns that we came up with at the end of the day yesterday. So again, I guess the other housekeeping thing is if there was some modification you wanted to see to that document, because I know you all went back after dinner and read through it. So, but anyways, those were like the list of concerns, our verticals, I'm sort of calling them, that you want to apply to the sections of the report. And then as we identify reconsideration requests, you may be reading those again with that same perspective or that same prism. And those that signed up for C will also be looking at the Ombudsman report, again, looking again through the prism of that document we created last thing yesterday.
Sorry, to the chair, Carlton Samuels, for the record. So what I was mentioning, Chair, is that the list of concerns, the verticals, we will finalize them because I think there were still some little things that we were looking at, no? Additional details.
We had no open questions other than are there things that you would like to see changed. So we didn't have open discussion topics.
Okay.
So it can still be a living document. If you think of things as you're going through, it's not set in stone, but it's meant to be a kind of a guideline and a prism through which to do this other reading.
Okay.
And that we can easily kind of roll things together in a standardized way so that we can then take the whole vertical and look across these processes to see how they did.
That's right. Thank you for the record.
Okay. Stan, go ahead.
Is your sense the product of this is a report to the larger group, or is it a written document? What's the output supposed to be of these activities?
Yes. So yes, it is my sense that this will be. It can begin in chicken scratch form, outline form, et cetera. But the idea is that it's going to be end up being a portion of our review that will be a written document. So as we discussed yesterday, we probably want to structure that document around the verticals more so than around these sections. And so figuring out how best to combine them together and maybe a drafting exercise that gets assigned differently, because we may have someone take the issue of underserved communities, for example, and be the person that drafts the roll-up of the comments that are created by these groups. So I wouldn't over-wordsmith them in the near term, but just make them sufficiently detailed that we know what the findings were. And then we'll look at how best to draft that portion of the report, which may, again, be a totally different drafter that's taking a series of reports. Okay? All right, great, thanks. So we're going to pause on this and head into the registry agreements. Startup compliance with Krista, Maggie, Ellen. Welcome.
So this is Aliza, just to give a little intro to what we're hoping to accomplish. So yesterday we had briefings for you on the history of the program and then the application evaluation process with the discussion about the program implementation report. So we wanted to pick up on that thread and provide a little more insight into what happens when you are now a contracted party with ICANN. So we have Alan, Krista, Maggie, and also from Maggie's team, Jennifer, who are here to give you some more insight, some briefing details on how they work with registries and so on and so forth. And then we're going to they're each going to speak for a few minutes, but we're also going to have plenty of time for questions and discussions. So I'll let Alan go first.
So hi, I think I know most of the people in the room, but for those of you who don't know me, I'm Alan Grogan, and I've worn a couple of different hats while I've been at ICANN. So I was in charge of the contracting process for the new GTLD agreements during the time that most of them were signed up, and I've since taken over the compliance department, so I'm no longer part of the legal department. So I'm going to talk briefly about Specification 11 and Specification 13 and kind of the history and evolution of them. I know Elisa panicked when she saw the number of slides I had. I assured her that I would barrel through this in about 10 minutes, so I'm going to do a real quick overview without going into a lot of detail. I provided the slides in case you want more detail. So,
Alan, just this is Jonathan. I just want to one moment say that there are folks in the room that have zero history with ICANN. So when you get to an acronym or something like that, it's worth just spelling it out.
Okay, I will try to do that. So Specification 13, Specification 11 is called the Public Interest Commitment Specification, sometimes referred to as PIC or PICS. And I'm going to briefly describe the history and evolution of it because I think that's useful if you haven't been part of this process to understand how it arose. So the GAC Toronto communique advised ICANN that statements and commitments and objectives that were set forth in the application submitted by registry operator applicants somehow needed to be transformed into binding contractual commitments. And there was nothing in the applicant guidebook or the initial draft of the registry agreement that would have accomplished that. So in early 2013, ICANN proposed the addition of Specification 11. And at that time, there were basically two additional requirements added to Spec 11. One was a requirement that new GTLD registries only use registrars that were signatories to the 2013 Registry Accreditation Agreement, RAA. And then the other one was to say, if you want to make voluntary commitments over and above what is part of the standard registry agreement, let us know what those are, and those will become binding and enforceable commitments that are part of the agreement. And those fell into, broadly speaking, kind of two subcategories. One was, tell us if there are things that you stated in your application that you are willing to make as binding contractual commitments. And the other was to say, even if you didn't state it in your application, are there things that you want to voluntarily commit to over and above what's part of the standard agreement? Next slide. Then, in response to the Beijing communique, Specification 11 was expanded to include additional commitments that apply to all strings. And I'm not going to go through these in detail. They're listed here. You can read Specification 11, but a number of these are passed through, a number of provisions that wound up in various parts of Specification 11 over time are pass-through requirements. So the registry operator must include in its agreement with the registrar a requirement that the registrar include in its agreement with the registrant certain commitments on the part of registrants. So one of those was a pass-through requirement that prohibits registrants from engaging in certain kinds of illegal and abusive behavior that's listed here. One requirement was that registry operators need to conduct periodic technical analysis to assess whether domains in the GTLD are being used to perpetuate security threats. And one was a broad statement that the GTLD be operated in a transparent manner consistent with general principles of openness and non-discrimination by establishing, publishing, and adhering to clear registration policies. So next slide. The GAC also advised that for strings representing generic terms, exclusive registry access should serve a public interest goal. There's a long, convoluted history on this where we went out and asked applicants to describe how they were serving the public interest. In the interim, we adopted a provision in Spec 11 that simply said if a registry operator was operating a generic string, they could not limit registrations exclusively to a single person or entity or that person or entity's affiliate. So we simply said you can't have exclusive registry access if you're operating a GTLD that's a generic term, and we've never really addressed the question of whether you could do that if you served the public interest goal. Next slide. Then and the GAC also advised that additional specific safeguards should apply to strings that it identified as sensitive strings linked to regulated or professional sectors, and those are sometimes referred to as Category 1 strings. So there were special requirements, again, a lot of these in the form of pass-through requirements, so registrants are required to commit to comply with applicable laws. Registrants who collect and maintain sensitive health and financial data have to implement reasonable and appropriate security measures commensurate with offering those services, and registry operators need to proactively create a clear pathway for establishing a working relationship with relevant regulatory bodies. Next slide. Registrants need to provide up-to-date administrative contact information for notification of complaints or reports of registration abuse. Registrants need to represent that they possess any necessary authorizations, credentials, or licenses for participation in the sector that's associated with the registry TLD string. Registry operators need to consult with the relevant national supervisory authorities regarding the authenticity of those licenses or credentials if a complaint is received, and registrants need to report any material changes to the validity of those licenses or authorizations. Next slide. Then there were certain specific strings that were deemed to pose risks of cyberbullying or harassment. So for .wtf, .sucks, .fail, and .gripe, there was a specific additional requirement added to Specification 11 saying that they needed to include a provision to address those issues. Next slide. And then for other specific strings that were deemed to create the possibility of confusion that they might be affiliated with governments because they're uniquely governmental functions, a specific provision was added so that the registrant had to represent, if they're .Army, .Navy, .Air Force, that they not misrepresent that they're somehow affiliated with or sponsored by or endorsed by the government's military forces if that sponsorship or endorsement doesn't exist. So if they are sponsored or endorsed by the U.S. Army or Air Force, they can say that, but if they're not, they can't misrepresent that. And then we came up with PICDRB, and taking your comments to heart about trying to not confuse people who aren't familiar with all the acronyms we use. That's a Public Interest Commitment Dispute Resolution Procedure, PICDRP, which provides a mechanism for impacted parties to complain to ICANN if they believe someone is not complying with the PIC. And there are kind of two paths that can be followed. One would be the compliance department could take that up as a compliance matter, and or we could refer that to an independent panel for resolution. And those could both be done, or either one of those could be pursued. Next, Specification 13. So Specification 13 applies only to brand owners, trademark owners. And this was different. This didn't arise out of GAC advice. This arose because a group, kind of self-formed group within the ICANN community called the Brand Registry Group, approached us back at ICANN, I think initially at ICANN 46, that was before my time here, and continued those discussions for several meetings, and said, look, the nature of some of these brand owners who want to apply for a TLD that represents a brand name is such that we're not going to have a large number of registrants. The registrants may only consist of the brand owner itself, or maybe the brand owner itself and a few affiliated entities. We don't intend to open this up to hundreds of thousands of registrants. We think a number of the safeguards that are built into the new GTLD agreements are really intended to apply to TLDs where there are a large number of registrants. We think those are unnecessary and burdensome. If I'm going to be the only registrant, or myself and five subsidiaries are going to be the only registrants. And then they also asked for the protection of their intellectual property rights in the trademark, that following any termination or expiration of a brand registry agreement, we not immediately redelegate that TLD to somebody else, because because that could create confusion. So if I have a brand name, .Microsoft or something, and I give it up, they didn't want us to delegate .Microsoft to somebody else without some sunset provision. So next slide. So there were three changes basically imposed by Specification 13. One was an exemption from the Code of Conduct, and you can read the Code of Conduct, which is in Specification 9, I believe, but that's mostly safeguards around registrants. The other is that registry operators generally are supposed to allow non-discriminatory access to registry services by any authorized registrar who signed the 2013 RAA. They said, if I'm only going to be registering names to myself and a few affiliated entities or trademark licensees, why do I need to open this up to 100 registrars? So we said, fine, you can limit the number of authorized registrars to as few as three. And then the sunset provision, we agreed that we would not delegate the TLD to a successor registry operator for 2 years without their consent, unless we reasonably determine that transitioning operation of the TLD is necessary to protect the public interest. So we do have the right to delegate it to somebody else if we think there's a valid reason that's necessary to protect the public interest, but otherwise we wouldn't do that for a minimum period of 2 years. By the way, even without Specification 13, there's a general provision elsewhere in the agreement that says following expiration or termination of any TLD agreement, we will take into account the registry operator's intellectual property rights in deciding whether to redelegate it to somebody else. So we probably would have taken this into account anyway, but for the brand owners who qualify, we agreed to the specific provision. Next slide. To qualify for Specification 13 for these brand registry requirements, it's not automatic. You have to submit an application to us and be approved. Your TLD must be identical to the text of a registered trademark, so it can't be a variation on it. It must be an exact match. That has to have been recorded with the Trademark Clearinghouse. It has to be used by the registry operator or an affiliate in the ordinary course of business in connection with the goods or services that are specified in that trademark application. Has to have been issued prior to the filing of the TLD application with ICANN. The reason for that is we wanted to avoid gaming. So we didn't want somebody who had a generic term to apply for a TLD and then go to a jurisdiction where you could actually get a registered trademark on a generic term and say, I'm a brand owner, I qualify for Spec 13. Has to be used continuously throughout the term, can't begin with a period or dot, and has to be used in connection with goods and services unrelated to the provision of GTLD registry services. So if you have a trademark for automobiles or computers or software, you qualify as a brand, but not if you're trying to protect a brand that's core to the registry business. Next slide. Only registry operator, its affiliates, or trademark licensees can be registrants. The TLD can't be a generic string, and as part of the evaluation process, you have to provide us with a complete copy of that trademark registration, so we don't need to go search for it. Next slide. That's it in terms of my presentation. I don't know if you want to do questions now or let Krista and Maggie do their presentations and then take questions at the end.
I think given some folks' unfamiliarity, it would be better to break it up and do questions as we go. So, Megan, do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, thanks. That was very useful. It's always useful to refresh our memory, especially those of us who are over 25. Can you just go back to one of your previous – that's it. Whoops. The next one. Because I can't remember the details. Yeah, exactly. I wanted to ask you if you could give us an example of a brand TLD that where did I see it now? Yes, that's it. You said that it has to be used in the ordinary course of business, but it can't be related to registries. Registry services, exactly. Can you give us an example of something that would be a brand that's related to registry services, just so I can have an idea?
Sure.
It's related to branches.
Yeah. So if you had, if I started Grogan Registry Services, and my business was providing registry services, and I got a trademark in Grogan for that purpose, then I don't qualify as a brand TLD. I need to use Grogan for some other goods or services unrelated to the provision of registry services.
Yep, David Taylor for the record. Alan, has there ever been, on Spec 11, has there ever been a brand that successfully argued, well, has anyone successfully argued that their exclusive TLD is in the public interest?
So we never had to reach that question because we put a provision in Spec 13 that simply said if you were generic, you didn't qualify for it. We did, and Krista can correct me if I'm wrong here, we did go out to all of the applicants and ask them if they were generic, can you please explain how you believe you serve a public interest goal? And we did get responses back from a number of them. But in the interim, we just put in this placeholder provision that said we're simply not going to grant a Spec 11 to somebody who's generic, and we've never tackled the issue of what level of justification you'd need to establish in terms of serving a public interest goal to get a Spec 11. The vast majority of applicants who had applied for generic strings said we don't intend to operate in an exclusive manner, and that kind of solved the problem.
It's Jonathan, and I'm sorry, I just don't even remember this, but one of the things was it was a minimum of three registrars as part of Spec 313. Is zero also a reasonable number? If it's one or more, it has to be at least three.
So that was part of the negotiations, and I think we had gone out for public comment with a proposal that they could have as few as one, and there were objections to that, so we ended up saying, no, you must open it up to at least three.
So there has to be a registrar involved, so even a thought, yes. Facebook that wanted to automatically give domains would have to go through a registrar.
Out in Simon's for the record. We had a lot of kerfuffle about this. There's three accredited registrars, and they must be accredited to 213 RAA. That was it. Minimum of three, and they must be accredited on the 213 RAA.
So this is Jordan. Let me maybe ask a clarifying question, because my interpretation of the agreement's different than Carlton's. I think it's a maximum three, not a minimum of three, because some registrar, some brands use more than one registrar in order to manage their portfolio. So I think that's the intent of the three. Is that Krista's nodding? But
yeah, for the people who can't hear my head shaking, yeah. So the Spec 13 actually says we'll designate no more than three accredited registrars, but they still are required to use registrars to register names. So that would mean you need at least one registrar in order to register names, but no more than three.
Right. And separately from that, Krista, there's a provision in the registry agreement that allows a registry operator to self-allocate up to 100 TLDs for the purpose of the promotion of the TLD. But if you want to use it for anything else or have more than 100 names, then you need to use an accredited registrar.
Correct.
So my misstatement. I apologize.
David Taylor for the record. Although it's change requests, if for the brands, we've been talking about brands, and this happens obviously quite a lot where brands take over other brands. If you've got, for instance, a .Google, to take an example here, and they get taken over by Apple, and they decide they want to change, and they want to change .Google to .Goople, they'd have to file a change request. Have you had any of those? And this is it's a serious question just on the basis for the future rounds and that how we're going to deal with this in the future, because it's bound to happen, this situation, and how is that going to be dealt with, and how have you Have you actually had to deal with that yet?
So this is Krista Papik, ICANN staff. So you're asking about the top level then. Can they change that? Yeah, so the current, and I don't know even if Karen wants to tackle this, so you currently cannot change the string. I'm sure there, I know people have asked for it over time, but we've never allowed that. So you have, you get the string that you have and you stay with that. Now, whether that's impacted by future rounds, which I think somebody else mentioned, or there's some other thing that comes into play, remains to be seen, but currently they cannot change the string at the top level.
And I think in addition to that, one consideration in, you know, in an acquisition, merger context or whatever would be the new entity, the successor entity, would still have to meet the Specification 13 requirements, so they would still have to be actively using the brand and so forth. And if they didn't, they would lose Spec 13 for that. So, you know, sometimes in a merger or acquisition, somebody changes their branding, ceases to use, you know, HP no longer uses Compaq or something, and in that case, had they gotten a Spec 13 for Compaq, they wouldn't qualify for it anymore.
Yeah, thanks. And David, again, just following up on that, because it's the thought of, it was more sort of whether it's an issue which you've had the requests from brands where there's been that situation, because obviously if you know, maybe a brand which becomes defunct, so the question is can they exchange it for their new brand in some way, and whether they've just made requests and you've said, no, you can't do that, it's not permitted. So it's really whether it was a problem that was live or whether it's a problem that actually you've hardly had any queries from brands about.
Just to respond to that, I know I'm sorry, I think this lady would like to get in the queue. It's Krista again. So just to be clear, we've had people request to change the strings. I haven't paid attention specifically whether it's a brand or not a brand, but there's certainly been requests over the years to do that. And, to just kind of correct, there hasn't been a process, or that's not been something that we've been able to do so far. So,
yes, thanks very much. Just a simple last question. Well, not last. The chairman determines.
This is Megan Richards.
Yes, Megan Richards, for the record, excuse me. I'm curious about the number of PIC DPDs or PIC PDPs or whatever they're called, the PIC DRPs, that's right, dispute resolution process have been held.
So the answer is so far zero. There have been, Maggie can speak to this, there have been, we have a on our website, we have a place where you can submit a PIC complaint. We've had several people submit PIC complaints, but when we've looked at those, we've determined they don't really fit within that category. Somebody just found their way to that web page and kind of submitted a complaint there, and when we looked at it, we realized it was not really a complaint about a failure to comply with public interest commitments, and we've never convened a PIC DRP panel to look at that.
This is Jonathan Zook again. I guess for just the benefits of some folks in the room about Spec 11, is it possible to spend a few minutes providing some context around that? Because in some instances, people volunteer to take on these things to overcome objections. And what's some of the context for that for folks that don't have the history here for the commitments that people actually made? I guess it's the non-application commitments, maybe, is what that category, that rather innocuous-sounding category, and maybe spell that out a little bit for folks that weren't here.
So it's Krista. I'm not sure I understand what you're asking for, Jonathan. So the context around, like, why people would do that, or?
That's exactly right. On the face of it, why would I agree to put anything into a contract and make it binding if I didn't have to? So as a layman, that the whole thing seems absurd to me. That's the question I'm asking on behalf of folks that weren't here.
Thanks. It's Krista again. I have a feeling that people might be saying that more than once, that they, why would I want to do that? I think, Alan, you might have touched on it a little bit, but just to maybe say it a little bit differently. So, Alan made a point earlier that the applicant guidebook and the applications themselves there wasn't necessarily information in there that said that every single thing you put in your application is going to be contractually binding. The applications were submitted by applicants. They provided all kinds of information, some of it technical, some of it operational, some of it related to different things they wanted to do with the TLD. So some of it, that being said, the governmental advisory committee had once, I need to go back and validate my timing, but I think it was after the applications became public, the governmental advisory committee was asking that that applicants commit to whatever was in their applications. And it was after they'd been submitted. So the compromise that came out of that was that applicants could, if they wanted to, volunteer to commit to some or all of the things in their applications, or they could have make additional commitments that they might want to make. We wouldn't speculate on, I think just logic says that the reason some of them did, the governmental advisory committee at that time also was expressing concern over certain strings, over certain applications, should there be a dot bank or not, as one example. And so the opportunity to make these voluntary public interest commitments, I think some applicants saw as an opportunity to sort of make the governmental advisory committee or help them feel a little bit better about some of those things.
Just one other piece of context. In parallel to this process, the GAC in some cases had issued what's called an early warning advisory to some applicants. So some applicants were on notice that the governments had some intent to scrutinize their applications, and so that may have influenced their thinking on this topic.
Little Carlton Samus for the record, a little color to it. It came out of the early warnings. I was on the ALAC at the time, and there was some interesting conversations that went on about what this meant. And so we thought the public interest commitments should be binding, and some of us believe that therefore you would have these specifications. We support the specifications. I didn't. I actually am on record saying that they weren't worth a warm bucket of spit. That is still my position. If you're going to make something voluntary, and then you're going to come back and tell me that I have to have it binding in an agreement, and then you're going to check me on that, well, what is the interest that I would have in doing that? I didn't see it that way, and I still don't see it as relevant.
The nature of this review is we're trying to get down a level from a high-level discussion of this, and so the color commentary is, I think, really critical here, and it is, in fact, completely illogical that anybody would voluntarily sign up for something to be binding if it didn't need to be. So, so unless there was some market differentiation component to it, or it was the result of early warning and to overcome a potential objection, I think we need to really bring that discussion to the surface for it to be valuable, because saying that there's things I mentioned in there, people might want to make them binding is just, it doesn't pass the laugh test. Go ahead.
So extraordinary. And so one thing that I haven't mentioned until now, but now seems like a great time to mention it, is there the registry stakeholder group has convened a group of registries that are interested in making themselves available to the CCTRT if we have questions about their operations or anything about anything that would help us. It may be this would be the sort of question we would want to take to them. Google Registry did not enter into any voluntary picks, so I couldn't tell you why someone would do it, because we did not. But many other registry operators chose to do this, and so we could probably consult with a set of people and ask them why they did it.
And I was just going to say, which I think you already hit on, this is Alan Grogan for the record, I can't speculate as to what the motivation was, because we just asked them to submit picks and not explain why, but I think there are registry operators who decided to include picks because they felt for marketing and promotional purposes it was a good thing to do. They weren't subject to GAC advice, they hadn't received early warnings, but they thought there was some competitive advantage to being able to say, we're applying these additional safeguards, and we want to, we don't want to put that in our registration policies that could change over time. We actually want to make this a binding commitment and kind of advertise that. That's speculation on my part, but.
Krista Papik again, just one more thing. So the voluntary picks were published, and they're on our website. It's kind of going back to Jordan's point, there's certainly the stakeholder group, but also you can see who all of the applicants at the time were that submitted voluntary picks if you did want to try and consult with some of those. There's, I think, about 500, I'm working from memory again, and about 300 of them came from donuts. So there's another, there's one plus, you know, another couple hundred if you guys wanted to take a look at that or reach out to those folks.
And do we know how many of them did have early warnings?
Not off the top of my head, no.
Great. Stan, thanks.
This is Stan. Did you say that things that applicants said they would do in their applications then might have chosen not to do afterwards, and that's been okay?
No, I didn't say that. I said that members of the community or different groups in the community were asking for them after they submitted the application to be contractually bound to everything in the application, and that the solution for that was that they could volunteer to become contractually bound to things in the application that maybe wouldn't normally be part of the registry agreement.
But some things they said in their application they would do, they might now not be bound to do.
That is possible, yes.
And it's certainly, Stan, there is a representation of warranty in the contract that says something along the lines of when I sign this contract, everything I said in the application sort of is true, but that doesn't persist beyond it's not an ongoing obligation beyond the initial representation.
I was raising it because I thought you might be puzzled, and I'm trying to actually surface this conversation for people that are new to this whole process, because it's so it's one of the things we should look at separately is those motivations, and I didn't know if we had any statistics about it. That's right. So I'll stop trying to be a proxy for anyone. Is there anybody that has additional questions that? All right, so let's move on to the next presentation, I guess. Thank you.
Now that you're familiar with my voice, Krista Papik, I am the Director of Registry Services and Engagement, and basically what there's a team of us and our responsibilities. I'm going to talk about a little bit. What I'll first do is explain to you who our team is and sort of what we do, what our core areas of responsibility are. And then the team asked me to talk a little bit about some of the key themes that we've seen. Just in general, our team works to support the registry operators and the different, we call them services, that they need to have in place in order to be in compliance with their contract. So the registry services team is responsible for all of that. And so we really are sort of dealing with them post-contracting, post-delegation, post-application process, and supporting them in their ongoing operations. So once I tell you a little bit about the team, I'll just talk a little bit about some of the key themes we've seen so far with the new GTLD registry operators. I'll talk about a little bit about where we tend to get involved to help out, and then maybe touch on some of the bigger areas of challenge that we've seen as we've gone along. So first of all, the team, we have two roles with one goal. Engagement manager is one of the hats that the members of the registry team wear, and really what that means is they're responsible for the relationship with the applicants only. There's not that many left anymore. They're mostly registry operators now, and the registry operators. That relationship between them and ICANN. Then they have a service manager hat. So the contract itself between ICANN and the registries has a whole bunch of things in it that registries have to do, and I'll give you some examples in a few minutes. Most of those things, or many of those things, need to be supported by, for instance, a dispute resolution procedure, and providers to handle those disputes, or some sort of published process for how you apply for something or request something or make changes to your contract, et cetera. And so those are what we call services. It's sort of, we've been trying, ICANN, as we've been scaling the organization, trying to sort of create common terminology that you find in non-oversight body businesses, regular businesses. So we look at them, we call these services. So the team, overall our goal is to work with the registries to make sure they understand their contract, that they can do the things that they need to do. And this, you know, ultimately helps to ensure a more secure and stable Internet. So the two – oh, this isn't very easy to see in here. Sorry about that, folks. The two areas of responsibility, just to give you a little some examples on the – first on the right side of the screen, the relationship management. So, again, we're the primary interface with the registry operators. Oh, thank you. Much better. So we make sure that they're that we understand that what their needs are and how to help them, you know, be successful and make sure that those get articulated back into cross-functional teams and things that go on in, inside of ICANN, the company. We keep them informed on what's going on, or we at least try, and communicate relevant developments to them or let them know about things that are going on that might impact them. And then, again, we coordinate with other departments inside of ICANN to deal with things that might affect applicants, registries, and other relevant global stakeholders. On the service manager side, we define, implement, and maintain the various registry products and services. That can include implementing ICANN policies, Catholic consensus policies, that relate either mostly or completely to registry operators, identifying service needs, so as things change, and they certainly have over the past 3 years. There's new, sometimes there's new things that have to be built to support requests from registry operators or services that they want to implement. We define the business requirements. We administer related public comment periods, coordinate cross-functional teams, and develop briefing papers for executive management and the board. So just to give you kind of an idea of the registry service areas, bless you, we've basically created 8 different buckets of core areas of services, contracting, registry. So the big squares in the middle of the screen are the buckets, and the print that's either above or below the bucket is just an example of a service that would fall into that bucket. So under contracting, RA renewal and management is something we would call a service. Under registry onboarding, establishing launch programs. So there's certain things that the registries have to do at startup before they can become generally available to the public, and we call those their launch programs. Dispute resolution procedures, uniform rapid suspension is one example. We already talked about the public interest commitments. Dispute resolution procedure, or the PICDRP, is another example that will fall in our dispute resolutions bucket. Registry agreement administration, evaluation services, and you guys can see the rest on the screen. So it just gives you an idea of some of the services. I think in registry we have something like, I'm trying to remember, I've lost count. I think we have about 35-ish services that fall into these buckets. The team itself, they're assigned accounts based on geography, and then they're assigned services. So they're a primary or a secondary manager for some portion of the 35 services. And then the next slide is just to give you an idea of where everybody is. So we have the registry team is based out of all 3 ICANN hubs. We have a couple people in Asia Pacific. These are their smiling faces. Some people in Europe, and then a team here in Los Angeles, of which Dennis Chang is in the room. So that's just about the team and sort of what we do. As far as key themes goes that we've seen throughout the startup of these new registry operators, I'd say the most common theme that we've seen is, and I don't have slides for this, I'm just going to talk now, but the most common theme that we've seen is just kind of a general lack of understanding, and it has to do with, this is new for everybody, including ICANN. It's one thing to, you know, we have a registry agreement. It's one thing to write a contract, and it's a completely different thing to actually live the contract. And so as we start, people start becoming contracted and going through different things they have to do, you start to run into the practical challenges of doing those things, and what does that really mean, and how does that really happen, and how do you translate it, that into tasks as opposed to just contractual legal language. And so the lack of understanding is not just, it's not just registry operators, it's even us just trying to figure out how we bridge that gap between execution and sort of theory. And so some of the places where we've seen challenges is in the startup processes themselves, about some of the language in the registry agreement, and even one sort of silly example, but like all contracts, we have a provision in there on how do we give you like legal notice that we're doing something, and the wording is probably one of the few sections that probably wasn't, I don't recall being very highly debated of all the sections that were debated. I think it was just kind of a carryover from previous agreements, and when you read the way it's written, it's really hard to scale. That language works really well for 20 or 18 registries. It doesn't work so well for 1,200. And it, for instance, it has a provision that will, you know, send something by courier or email and then snail mail. Or like courier works great for 18. It doesn't work so good for 1,200. So there's things like that you come across in there and trying to figure out, like, how do we – the registry agreement says what it says. So that is our governing, you know, terminology. But how do we make this work from a scalability perspective as well? And then really one of the other big common themes just in general lack of understanding was how do the registries work with ICANN? Everybody was sort of used to living in this application world where the interaction with ICANN was very different from how registry operators, contracted parties prior to new GTLD round had interacted with ICANN. And so there's a whole bunch of new players who only knew how to interact with us as an applicant, and they didn't understand how to interact with us as a contracted party. And so really just building out that relationship with them and even getting documentation out to them to explain to them how to do certain things was one of the things that we had to work fast and hard to get to. In general, the places where the registry services team has been called in to help and has been helping for the past few years is really in communication. So this general lack of understanding, misunderstanding between us and registries has been largely gapped. The gap has been largely filled by some form of communication. And it started, I think, at the very beginning with just regular engagement with the stakeholder group, which, of course, is not comprised of all registry operators, but it was just a starting point. We built out the team and started having them have proactive engagements with applicants and registries just to kind of help open up the dialogue. And then as that's progressed, the team has become an escalation point for registries and applicants. So if they're trying to get something done here with ICANN, they're trying to get a question answered, and they don't feel like they're getting what they need, they can always escalate it to a dedicated account person from the registry team who can help them figure out how to get what they need. We've been, as I just mentioned a minute ago, working to create more more external documentation that we publish. So there's some processes that have been around for a long time that registries have been using that, registries before this round were using that knew very well how to use them. But it wasn't really clear from our published documentation for somebody who was brand new to this ecosystem, like, how do I get this done with ICANN? So we've been supplementing what's been published with just like instructional guides and things like that. And then lastly, we've done some training or what we called a roadshow, where we went out to a couple different we went out to three different regions of the world, invited the registries to come join us, and we kind of just worked through. We had a bunch of workshops on on the contract itself and on the different services that they may need to use and how to use them, how to go through startup, how to request a change to a service in their contract, et cetera. And then finally, just on the topic of some of the bigger challenges, I think, you know, the thing that we've seen as one of the biggest challenges related to this ongoing operations of these registries is that some of the tools that are used, some of the services that are used, were developed a long time ago. And they were developed, again, when we had a much smaller pool of registry operators, 18. The environment was very different. And when you bring a whole bunch of new players into this, they have different ideas. They are they want to do things that that they've come up with, and they're reading the contract, and it sort of says, well, we if you want to make some changes, and I'm going to give you guys an example in a minute, you know, here's the process you follow. That, again, the process was developed a long time ago and doesn't maybe scale or doesn't really work in the new environment. And so one of the areas that we have this, so in the contract, the registry operators need to they have registry services that they provide, what we call registry services. there's a consensus policy out there called the Registry Services Evaluation Policy. RSEP. It basically says that if a registry wants to change or add a new service, and there's a specific definition that's articulated there, that they need to come work with ICANN on that first. ICANN will evaluate the service to make sure that there's no significant security, stability, or competition issues. And then there's kind of a process you go through, and then assuming that there are no issues with those three areas, work with the registry to allow that service to be implemented. And implementation almost always means you have to amend the contract to say, okay, you can now do this thing. The RSEP policy itself was finalized in 2006. Again, it was a much smaller world back then, and it's very different. I mean, just the physical world has changed a lot since 2006. So so some of the services that we've seen that have been challenged, sometimes the services they want to add are specific to the business model that they have. So, for instance, a registry might be targeting a very specific audience, and they want to, before you can get a domain name in that GTLD, the registry might want to verify that you're actually fit in that specific group that they're targeting. And the way that you do that is through some sort of registrant verification or validation service. Depending on how they implement it, it needs to go through the RSEP or it doesn't. But it's sort of it creates this bit of a struggle, because sometimes the registry, they feel like they've already sort of covered this somewhere, and that why do they need to go through the RSEP? It also, sometimes the registries want to implement a service, an idea that they've thought of. They want to be first to market with it. But the RSEP process, it's ICANN, so it's very public. So, you know, if you think about, they've got a new business idea, they come to us, we publish it, everybody gets to look at it, and then eventually, after some period of time, you know, they may, if assuming it passes RSEP and there's an, you know, gets the contract amendment, they eventually get to implement it. So there's, it creates a bit of a challenge for them. Making it difficult for them to innovate or be first to market is what we hear from them. Sometimes there's also challenges where the service they want to implement, it interacts kind of in a funny way with other parts of the contract. And so one of the things we've seen there is registries wanting to implement third-level domain registrations. So my last name is Papik, my middle name is Lee, my first name is Krista. If I wanted Krista.Lee.Papik instead of Krista.Papik, the Krista.Lee.Papik is a third-level domain. There's really no language in our contract about that, and it does fit under the definition of a registry service in the consensus policy. But looking at how does that request interact with other provisions in the contract. For instance, things like Sunrise and trademark claims. If they're going to register third-level domain names or offer them, do those need to go through a Sunrise and a claims period? What if they do fourth level? Do those go through Sunrise and claims? What about fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth? So there's all of these sort of unique challenges that we're seeing now spring up that, you know, figuring out how to stay, abide by our consensus policies and our contract, but still, you know, and make sure that, you know, all of the other things that were are sort of in our remit and bylaws are being honored also. And then finally, the challenges here is that all of doing some of these things takes time. And again, you've got these companies that want to go implement a new service, and they're sort of trying to work through the processes with us, and it's causing them a lot of time to get some of those things done. And just to kind of go back to the registrant validation thing or verification, you know, some think that I've created a space that is supposed to be only for certain types of registrants. I didn't have this service in my contract when I signed it. I need to add it now. They're thinking of it as I'm creating some registries are thinking of this as I'm creating a sort of trusted space that it's about that subject matter. But I can't make it trusted yet because I have to go through all these processes with ICANN first. And that, you know, kind of creates a sort of an interesting dynamic and is, again, one of the more challenging things that we're still working through with registries. And that's it for my...
Are there questions now, or we also have Maggie's going to give her presentation.
Just a quick question. The CCTLDs are excluded from the registry service, isn't that correct? Or is it that some are in and some are out? I always get confused about who's in and who's out.
Sure, thanks. Yeah, so we're ICANN is just has oversight over the GTLD space. So CCTLDs sometimes ask us for something, not like in the context of a contract, but they might have a question. We're always happy to help, but we don't have oversight over them.
Carlos, for the record, how many requests for these new services have you seen from the new registries, or do you publish these numbers, or can they be found somewhere?
Thanks, Carlos. So all of the requests are published. There's sort of an initial discussion with ICANN that is not published, and we do a completeness check before we publish them. But once the request is considered complete, meaning it has everything it needs, we publish them. It's on our website. I'm happy to point you there. It is, to your point about how many, it's not that easy, truthfully, to weed through them. But I can tell you that, I'm working from my memory, but I think we're getting about 75 a year right now, where we used to get like 5 a year. Keeping in mind that of those 75, many of them are for multiple GTLDs. So they'll submit one request for all of their TLDs. So one could be for 100 TLDs. So it's definitely a much bigger number than it used to be.
Hi, Chris, it's Jordan. There's also, I believe there's some set of registries that included additional services in their application, and that was you guys added those services to their contracts at contracting time. Is that correct?
Sort of, yes. So so the applications, right, so there's a section in the application that asks for any additional registry services, and this is actually one of the areas that was really confusing. Some people didn't actually put the registry services in the registry services section. They put them somewhere else in the application. What we did at contracting is, for a couple of, I think, really good reasons, is we went through every application and tried to find what looked like registry services as best we could and put them into the draft, bless you, to the draft contracts that we gave them. But then we asked them to please review and make sure it had everything that they wanted. In some cases, people didn't realize that something was a registry service, and so, or they didn't, I don't know if people didn't look closely at their, the contracts we asked them to review, but there are instances where you might have had a registry service in your application. It didn't make it into your registry agreement, so it would need to be added through the RCEP
later on.
Sure. I'm just saying to Carlos's point, there's some set of new services that were added after contracting, and then there's some set that you guys evaluated and included in the initial contract as well, which wouldn't show up as RCEPs.
Correct. I'm sorry. Yes, thank you. Great point. Thanks.
Krista, Jonathan Zook, is there a notable difference in the number of registries that are using third parties to actually implement their registry services? And has that affected the way that you're interacting? I don't know if my assumption is correct or not, but I think it is that there's a lot more folks that are contracting with someone to actually run the back end of their registry. And is that higher propensity, given that there is one, something that has made it more or less complex to work with the registries? Answer their questions.
Thanks, Jonathan. It's Krista again. A lot of the registries have outsourced the delivery of registry services, basically to some sort of back-end technical provider or registry services provider is another term we use. It'd be interesting to actually look at the math on that because prior to this round, many of the existing TLDs actually were outsourcing as well. So the percentages might not be too far off, but because the scale is so much bigger, I think it does make a big difference. And there are more registry services providers now than there were prior to this round. So there's more of them. There's certainly more registries. I don't know if it's complicated is the right word. It makes the interactions more challenging because really we've sort of defined how we communicate and who we communicate with, but it's still a little bit challenged because sometimes you've got a business person who's technically the registry operator at some big company who's not familiar with this industry. They've outsourced the back end to somebody who's very familiar with this industry, but we communicate with our contracted party, right? We don't have a contract with the back end. So we're communicating with someone who doesn't understand that they need to go communicate with their vendor. And so those are some of the confusing things that we've struggled with a little bit. It hasn't complicated things. It's a matter, I think, more of just trying to get people to understand. And really for ICANN, we've been working on this to find additional mechanisms for making sure communications get to the right people so they can act.
Thanks, David Teller, for the record, Krista. You mentioned there, which is interesting, the unique challenges of third-level domains, so the krista.li.papak, which is a perfect example, and whether certain registry services should apply, et cetera. And I was just thinking there, obviously, you've got the issue as well where the URS could or could not apply, and even the UDRP, in a situation where you may google.li.papak, sorry to always pick on Jordan as I have to do here, and what you do with that issue of those sort of registrations. Have you had any internal thoughts about that with the URS, for instance?
Yeah, that also, thanks, David. That falls in the same. I just named off a couple, but URS would be one of them as well.
Any other questions? If not, I would like to leave the rest of the time for Maggie to make her presentation. Go ahead, Maggie.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Maggie Surratt. I'm looking around the table. I know and have had the opportunity to work with many of you, so it's good to see you. My role, I'm the VP in contractual compliance. I report to Alan. I've asked Jennifer to join me also today to make sure we address any questions you have in the registry space because she oversees the registry area in compliance. You had asked compliance to come and share, next slide please, to come and share with you what preparation efforts did we undertake to be able to work and enforce, to work with so many new players, but also to enforce the contract, but also to share with you some themes and activities that we work on. Next slide please. So from preparation for the new GTLD, it's an exercise we conducted in 2012. Basically, we looked at and assessed our organization as you hear us speak of staffing, systems, processes, and also knowledge and application of the contractual obligations. So we rolled out, many of you have heard me speak and present, whether at GNSO Council or a different stakeholder group meeting. But we did, in order for us to prepare for the new G world, as we refer to it, is we went and first started with the contract. We started with the contract before even the contract was signed. Compliance is involved internally and works within our internal organization, legal department, registry services, and we collaborate and review and provide our input. So we started the process very early in the game. And that process assisted us in laying out what needs to happen. What is the level of complexity? What are the areas of compliance we need to focus on? So we started building all the documentations that relate to it and focused on the systems. The old systems did not address registry complaints. It was mostly focused on registrars. So we focused on the staffing. Let me start with that one. The staffing, we generated and we assessed our model. What are the skill sets? What are the staffing models? I'm looking at Carlton. He's heard me talk to that to ALAC in a previous life. And when Fadi came on board and made the announcement of the Istanbul and Singapore hubs, we were the first to go in there, besides the regional VPs. We had already brought on staff in Singapore and in Istanbul to represent compliance in the hubs. Staff who is local, staff who is knowledgeable, and we started the training in preparation for this. We also centralized our system and added several. We refer to them as complaint types, just an internal referral, but it's really the different provisions that we need to be working with, but allow the outside world to also submit complaint forms to us about either non-compliance or alleged non-compliance. We also use the same central system for our internal teams. For example, if there is, let's just pick on finance. If for some reason an invoice or fees are not paid, compliance goes, finance goes through their normal process, and then if no actions are taken, they escalate by submitting a complaint to compliance and informing the contracted party that an escalation has been sent to compliance. I use this as the most simple example. A more complicated example of the consolidated system is also the interaction we have with the GDD team, where it's referred to as technical services. Technical services has different automations and tools to identify exceptions. Those exceptions get logged into our system and it allows us to work through the exceptions and address the non-compliance issues. This has been a very valuable approach because it does impact everything that we do with the community. And you will see me talk to that, how it gets to the metrics. We've enhanced the process and standardized it because, again, the registry agreement has different obligations. For example, the turnaround time, it's very unique in certain provisions, whereas in others it's open. But if you don't have a standardized approach, you can never really come to closure on any compliance issues if you do not institutionalize an operational approach in addition to the contractual obligations. Last but not least, I'm looking at Jonathan. We're going to celebrate our fifth anniversary, Jonathan and I. April 3rd is when I joined ICANN and I met Jonathan. Additional metrics. You can only imagine the level of increased metrics we have put in place, but we also continue to improve on that metrics. I mean, we have not finished our journey. This is ongoing. So preparation for the new G, what does that mean? It's not just preparation from staffing processes, systems, and tools, but also, as you know and you have observed, a lot of the newcomers, the new TLDs, are existing operators. So we had a process in the past that we do compliance checks for contract renewals in the old world, Well, guess what? The new world brought contract signing and contract assignments in addition to whatever combination of change a contract can bring you. So we expanded the contractual compliance check to include those additional services. So before a contract signing occurs, if you've heard us speak to it at the updates at the ICANN meetings, before a TLD is delegated, we perform a contractual compliance check to find out, one, if they are in the existing world, how are they behaving? And if they are in the existing world and have an affiliation with other areas, whether it's registrars or registries. So we look at a compliance check not just focusing on the TLD, but all-inclusive. And we provide that input into either the contract process or the process where it's led by the registrar services or registries for contract renewals. Compliance ramped up the proactive monitoring efforts. We still do some monitoring efforts manually, but we also have, like you heard me say earlier, with technical services, they have automated a lot of those. Some of the manual efforts we do, as simple as, you know, publication of abuse contact data. We just go on the website, are they fulfilling the obligations of publishing that information? We also have updated and developed and rolled out what we call a new registry agreement audit program. This audit program now has concluded two full audit phases, and we are in the third round. All this information is published, so I'm not going to dive into the details of the audit, but we, before we launch any audit, we communicate and we publish it at the ICANN meetings and on our website. The bullet that's really critical to improving the transparency and accountability is this bullet here. ICANN and contractual compliance publishes all the notices. This is what we refer to as enforcement notices. We publish any and all outreach updates, including the presentations that accompany them. We publish and we used to do monthly newsletters. This is in the early phases when we were introducing a lot of changes, and there were changes on a monthly basis. Now we've pulled back to what we call quarterly updates, but we also have a compliance annual report in addition to the reports that are published on a 13-month rolling basis that can be found, and a monthly dashboard. All this data is fed from our centralized system. So transparency begins from there, and it leads into the metrics that's visible to everyone. Continuous improvement, it's an ongoing effort for our department. It doesn't stop. We receive a lot of feedback, whether it's from the community about additional metrics or opportunities for improvement and reporting, from our contracted parties to help bring more clarity, or even from our own staff to help improve in process and in reviews. Next slide, please. The next two slides I'm providing for you here is just to give you an idea also. Contractual compliance, as you heard me say, isn't just when a contract is signed. Contractual compliance is a full circle. You heard me speak about the initial phases of the contract and the applications, but we also contribute heavily and collaborate with the working groups and the policy departments. We work on, this is the list of, it's not all inclusive, it's just a few list of items of efforts underway today that we answer questions to, we provide data to, or we provide input into policies that are in development, and again, it's informational. We're happy to take any questions on that. Next slide, please. One of the things that sort of be relevant for this audience, because it was also asked, is what are the trends or issues that compliance has seen since the launch? I heard earlier the question asked about the service providers, if I may just pause for a minute here. When we conducted the audits, you know, it's nice to say, I want to audit all 800-plus TLDs. Well, that's not doable. You have to put forth a strategy that handles and addresses what we call low-hanging fruit. So in this example, the service providers, as you were talking to earlier, there were many new introduced into this model. In addition, the model has exploded. I mean, there's hundreds of TLDs out there. So one of the areas we selected an audit strategy on is let's identify who are the service providers and how many registry operators are they servicing. And that was what we call a low-hanging fruit, because if a potential non-compliance is identified, there is the possibility that that issue can be addressed and it will trickle down to many other areas. So that's an approach. As Krista spoke earlier, our contractual obligations and communications are directly with the registry operator. So when we are working, we work directly with the contracted parties. This list here on this slide is most common compliance issues. Many of you are familiar that contractual compliance has put forth a process way back when I first started, not only to bring consistency, efficiency, and effectiveness into our work, but also to allow the transparency and the reporting back to the community. This process consists of what we call informal resolution and a formal resolution. The informal resolution process is where many of those compliance issues listed above here on this slide have been addressed. It allows us to collaborate directly with the contracted parties and address those issues. Informal resolution process, if it's not followed and there is no collaboration or no response or it's incomplete, if and when that happens, can lead to what we call an enforcement, which will be a notice of breach that's going to be published on the website and publicly made aware. We report on the entire process in aggregate form and in specificity as it relates to the enforcement aspect of it. So with this, I'm going to stop presenting, and I hope please take a look at the link provided to you in the presentation, in addition to what the support team, Elisa, Karen, and Anna have provided you in the CCT workspace on the metrics. This link will take you to the compliance page where many more metrics are provided. Thank you.
So it is our lunchtime, but I think we should take a few minutes for
questions. Yeah, sure. If there's questions, please.
I have what Jordan and many
Megan Richards.
Will, yes, Megan Richards, excuse me for the record. Jordan and many others will think is a really dumb question. But you identified something called the DNS abuse review. And is that something that is of potential interest to us in the context of our work?
Yes. This is Elisa. I can answer that. That's a stream of work that it's a report that's being produced that I think will be of most of interest to the Safeguards and Trusts Act subteam. But that is something that is being produced for this group to review.
So this might just be a lot of information for folks to absorb, I guess, and they'll probably be circling back with you as we try to, particularly that trust subteam, I think, will want to circle back with you. But everybody should know that compliance is doing a lot of the work to supply a lot of the metrics that we'll be using that were identified by the IAG. So we're very thankful to the work you've done to begin to collect metrics. Because the other thing that I remember from 5 years ago when I met Maggie was that the incident tracking was a folder in Outlook. That's what she inherited. So the fact that we're talking about metrics right now is very exciting. So thank you.
And I'm going to very briefly but go through where these metrics are that we have published online that Maggie referred to that our team has been collecting. After lunch. I would never stand between Jamie and lunch.
May I say one word? We welcome feedback, please. We welcome feedback with ideas. Don't just say, this stinks, it doesn't work. What is it you're looking for? What is it you expect? Help us define it. We cannot claim to have the answers. Don't tell me, I want you to measure this. What does this mean? Because, you know, we are truly a global organization. You know, we heard about that earlier from Alan and from Krista. I have a hard time understanding myself, and I speak three languages. So I flip languages. So everybody has a different expectation and metric. So please, our ask of the CCT team, when you take a look at this, let us know what is expected. Define it. What does a term mean when you're asking for it? And we'll do our best to work with you and define it further and provide you the data. Thank you for this opportunity and bon appétit.
When should we reconvene? At 1? Okay. So Kylie, Calvin, and Drew were taking a break for lunch. We'll be back on at 1 p.m. our time, which is about 55 minutes from now.